Representative Mullery, I see you just locking in. Good afternoon, members. Representative Mullery has the first go up. Representative Hillstrom has one as well. If you want to, are you ready, Representative Mullery, or would you like Representative Hillstrom to go first? You need to gather your thoughts here. Okay. I just asked Representative Hillstrom if she'd be willing to go first, but then you walked in, so here we are. Good afternoon, members. As you know, we have a lot of bills on the calendar, and we're going to, we don't have a quorum yet, so we're just going to go ahead and get started with Representative Mullery's House File 31. We'll move it when we have a quorum. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and is this just move for, or to lay over, or?
Representative Mullery, I was just...
Oh, no, this one...
This has to go to Pension Commission, but someone was just telling us that first it needs to go to GovOps to get to pensions. I don't know why that would be. So maybe we can make that motion when we've got it figured out. So maybe...
Usually goes to Pension Commission, later to GovOps.
I'm going to recognize Representative Carlson, who will probably be taking care of this, and he has a thought on that. Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, do you mind understanding that you go to the government office and then we can check on that if you'd like.
We do have a quorum now, so...
Madam Chair,
I think we want to move, if you do want to, Representative Mullery, the motion that Representative Carlson just suggested. Waiting for his motion.
Okay, whatever the motion is, I move.
Well, it's up to you. You're on the committee, and you make the motion, so I think Representative Carlson is saying we can't move directly to pensions.
So you want to take the move to... He'll check by the time...
He's going to check. Let's just go to House File 31 and talk about it when he's back.
Whoever the master is in the audience,
say goes to GovOps. Whoever the master is. Oh, I don't know who that is.
Who follows GovOps, yeah.
Okay. Your motion, Representative Mullery.
Would be to go to GovOps, then.
Representative Mullery moves House File 31, and Representative Mullery has an amendment. And Representative Mullery moves... I don't see it. Oh, Representative Mullery, you have an oral amendment? Yes, I'm looking for it. Representative Mullery, Mr. Michael knows your oral amendment. We're going to go to Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think the appropriate thing to do is to take the tax provisions out of this bill because that will be subsumed in the general federal update provisions and send the pension administration portion of the bill, which is Section 3, on to the Government Operations Committee. And so the appropriate amendment would be on page 1, delete Section 1, on page 2, delete Section 2, amend the title accordingly and correct the references and renumber. And I will give the clerk a copy of the amendment.
So all members have the motion. Therefore, Representative Mullery moves the amendment that Mr. Michael just explained to us. Discussion. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment carries. Representative Mullery, I think just for the committee members as they're getting situated here now, just so everyone understands, because we have had some time early in the session on conformity, and so conformity pieces stay here. The pension pieces are going somewhere else. Okay.
Madam Chair, exactly. But we didn't discuss this earlier in the federal conformity. And this was brought to me back in, I believe it was October, by the police in their pensions. And what it does is there's a federal exemption given up to $3,000 for health care insurance for public safety personnel, which includes quite a bit other than just what you might think of as police and fire. That takes it out of them having to pay income taxes on it. And it also includes the para and MSRS and I believe state troopers, things like that. And because of the large funds, they need this language that's going to GovOp, which has provisions that the pension plan can pay directly to the health insurance carrier the amounts that the retiree wants so that it will conform with what the federal requirement is. And it only applies to people who have been public safety officers as defined in the U.S. Code and retirees who stayed until full retirement. So many of them that retired early, even though they're getting pensions, can't get this exemption. And then the eligible person must make the election to the plan. But this language going to GovOp gives the plans the authority to make those payments directly, which they don't have right now. And the tax part of it was, it's very simple. It's just off of the part that they don't have to pay income tax on it and then pay the insurance company. So it's part of the federal conformity legislation. It's pretty simple.
Thank you, Representative Mallory.
And I think there's a number of people from law enforcement, at least maybe you'd let a couple of them at least
sure, that'd be great.
Speak on behalf of it.
I think first, if it's all right, I would like Representative Mallory to ask Representative Hillstrom to join us as well, because her bill has the same provisions minus the pension part that your does, so that we can get that, you know, before testifiers know that we've got a couple bills doing that. So if Representative Hillstrom wants to just explain her bill, and then we'll go to testifiers on both. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move that House File 1532 be laid over for possible inclusion. All right. Members, this is very similar to House File 8, the federal conformity piece that we already passed. In House File 8, we made this provision available for 2006. What this House File 1532 does is makes it for 2007 and ongoing. And so otherwise it has the same annual $3,000 exclusion as Representative Mallory's bill has as well. So I would stand for questions, Madam Chair, or have testifiers speak on behalf
of
you.
Thank you. Thank you. So members, and for the public to understand, most of these bills, there's a lot of provisions that are the same, but we'll take testimony on either one of these, and including the pieces that are moving to GovOps. Is there anyone from the public who would like to testify either for or against either one of these bills? Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bill Gillespie, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. I'm here to support both House File 31 and House File 1532. These bills, as were indicated earlier by Representative Mallory, grew out of some work that occurred in the federal area by a number of associations, one of whom is sitting next to me, Dick Nelson, in which under the Federal Pension Protection Act, special consideration were given to public safety officers who originally were injured in the line of duty. It since grew to be those folks who have achieved the age of normal retirement age also. So to cut to the chase, there isn't any way to do that except Representative Mallory's language. Obviously allows PERA and MSRS to withhold and make pre-tax dollars out of the $3,000 exemption for health benefits. Therefore, both pieces of this, even though they're traveling separately, both pieces of this are very necessary. Well, what's it going to cost you? I think that's the bottom line, usually, and there are about 5,000 people who presently could qualify under MSRS or PERA. That number comes out to be about $15 million of revenue, $15,000 of salary, in this case pension, multiplied by 5%. Which would be, I think, a good guess, which is all we're doing, good guess of what it would cost as far as lost revenue, comes out to about $750,000. That's if everyone took advantage of this. and that can take advantage. Public safety officers who are injured in the line of duty or who reach normal retirement age. The number will be smaller than that through time because, frankly, local jurisdictions pay some of the hospitalization for their members, for the retirees, and some people will not take advantage of it. They won't figure it out. So the number will be less than that $750,000 of actual lost revenue to the state of Minnesota. Not wanting to love the bill to death, is there any questions that you might have of me personally? And I believe that Dick Nelson and Eric Hyland from the Chiefs and Sheriffs wish to testify also.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Gillespie? Thank you, Mr. Gillespie. And thank you, Mr. Nelson, for coming. And Mr. Hyland, please join us. Welcome.
Madam Chair, Dick Nelson. I represent the Minnesota Police Pension Council and the Minneapolis Retired Police Association. I'd be one of these members affected by this. Health insurance has been a major, major problem for all of my people in this bracket, and we support the bill strongly that Representative Mallory has got here in favor of it.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Hyland.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Eric Hyland. I'm from the law firm of Meserle and Kramer, representing the Minnesota Chiefs of Police and the Minnesota Sheriff's Association today. And for the record, we also, our two organizations, strongly support Representative Hillstrom and Representative Mallory's bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, are there questions for Representative Hillstrom or Representative Mallory? Is there anyone in the public who would like to testify either for or against either one of these bills? If not, then members, Representative Mueller, oh, welcome, please. We have a very full agenda, so we're moving quick.
Madam members, my name's Mary Bannick. I'm with PERA. I just wanted to verify the numbers that were referred to earlier. We have the potential of $9 million of pension income that would be excluded if everybody participated. So that would be at 5%, roughly $455,000 a year. Currently, we have just under 500 people participating, excluding a little over $1 million of pension distributions. So your cost currently is about $55,000 in income.
Thank you. Welcome.
Madam Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom, the Director of the State Retirement System. We currently have 531 people using the provision. They are excluding income of $1.3 million. And at a 5% tax rate, that would be about $65,000. Our potential universe is 1,818. Again, at a 5% tax rate, the maximum revenue that you would lose at this point would be $272,000 from the state retirement piece.
Thank you for that. We appreciate it. Are there other testifiers? Sorry, I was moving quickly there. I apologize. If not, then Representative Mallory renews his motion, House File 31, as amended, to be referred to the Government Operations Committee. Discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. And now Representative Hillstrom moves House File 1532 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Tax Bill, and I will lay that over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Tax Bill. Thank you. And now we have House File 822. Is Representative Clark here? Not here. Representative Welty. Is Representative Welty here? There he is. Welcome, Representative Welty. And Representative Welty, you have two bills, and so we're going to start out with whichever one you'd like first. Representative Welty, would you like the small city one first? Or statewide. Where is that? Oh, yes, the small. Okay. Would someone like to move House File 406? I think Representative Demmer, is he here? He's a co-author. He's not here.
I'd be happy to move it now.
Representative Atkins moves House File 406. Welcome, Representative Welty.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. This bill is dealing with small city TIF, and I brought a visual along so that we could all understand what issue I'm talking about, because this issue really impacts a lot of the members sitting at the table. If you represent a city which is at a population over 10,000 people, There is a small city TIF provision that says that any small city that is 5,000 people or under, so population of 5,000 or less, and it's outside of a 10-mile radius of a regional center, you can qualify for a small city TIF. So as you can see, if you look at my map, here's the regional center, population 10,000 or over. You go 10 miles outside of that regional center, cities outside of that 10-mile radius can qualify for small city TIF. But cities within that 10-mile radius cannot qualify for small city TIF. So what we have is an issue where we may have, in my district for instance, I have a couple cities that are within a mile or two of the 10-mile radius. They do not qualify for small city TIF. I have a couple cities that are within 2 or 3 miles of that border on the other side. They qualify for small city TIF. So essentially, I can have two cities within a mile, 2 miles, or even 5 miles of one another. One city qualifies for small city TIF, and the other does not. There is a competitive disadvantage when they are trying to lure in businesses. The small city TIF provision only applies to office, commercial, and retail space. And it only applies to buildings that are 15,000 square feet or less. So we're not talking about giving small cities the ability to pull in large box stores or chain stores. We're talking about small storefronts on Main Street that a lot of these small cities want to attract, but in the case of my district, I have one small city. It's, like I said, within a couple miles of that radius. They cannot get small city TIF. I have another city about 4 miles away, and they qualify, and they can offer small city TIF. They have been able to lure in businesses, and businesses have given them a serious look. And so now we are having a disadvantage when we're trying to attract businesses in and around a regional center. So what this bill does is it says this. We're going to take the 10-mile radius away, and if you share a border with the regional center, then you cannot qualify for small city TIF. But anybody else can. And that is what the bill does in front of you. I believe this is about fairness. I believe this needs to be done. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Steve Gronseth, who is the Economic Development Director for the City of Iona.
Welcome. Thank you. Madam Chairperson, committee members, once again, I am Steve Gronseth, the EDA Director for the City of Iona. We are the city that's within the 10-mile radius. I just wanted to speak on behalf of this bill today. Small communities in our state of Minnesota need all the economic development tools that are available to survive. Right now, our community is experiencing a loss of basic services. And the interesting part is when you look at other communities of roughly the same size or even smaller that are located outside of that 10-mile radius, they still have some of those basic services that we lost a few years ago. Example being grocery store, hardware store. Some of those still have those things, and we do not. We're not actually playing on a level playing field when it comes to competing for potential businesses to come to our communities. I and some of my other participants have spoken to numerous businesses, and the first question we usually get is, do you have commercial TIF? When we reply in the negative, what typically happens is our conversation ends, and then later we hear that they just went a few miles up the road and are in serious conversation or have relocated to that other community that does have commercial TIF. We have commercial buildings that will sit empty in our downtown for years. We also, and they are, needless to say, falling apart in neglect in many cases. We just recently were able to talk to a commercial developer to at least look at our community. We were able to convince them to proceed with putting in a small commercial park for us, with the help of the USDA Red Lake loan grant program that was done through a local co-op. Unfortunately, this money is fairly limited, and we would not be able to do the same thing for a commercial business coming in. The developer and I have been talking to numerous businesses, and he's starting to get an education on what it's like to sit without TIF. He is deeply concerned about the prospect of it being a successful development in a small community and trying to sell his commercial lots to small retail businesses. Finally, it's important to our community to maintain its uniqueness and its own identity. We want to maintain the basic services to our citizens. In order to do this, we need the ability to be able to offer commercial TIF to potential new businesses coming to our community. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I want to just point out a few other things that you should consider. I spoke to the original authors of the TIF provision. And this was about a year ago, and I said, you know, do you think it's wise to take another look at this issue? And both of them replied, they said, I definitely would agree that you should take a look at it, see if there are any concerns, and, you know, see if that 10-mile radius needs to stay in place or not. They were open to it. So we contacted the League of Minnesota Cities, contacted the Minnesota Association of Small Cities, contacted the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. All of them contacted their membership. The League of Minnesota Cities sent out in 2 years, or 2 years in a row, sent out in their bulletin this very issue and explained it and asked for input. And we have not received resistance to this bill. We incorporated one suggestion to the bill, and that was to say if you share a border. So we put that in the bill. Otherwise, there's not resistance to this legislation from any of the coalitions. And I actually have here with me Dave Engstrom with the Minnesota Association of Small Cities to speak on behalf of this.
Welcome, Mr. Engstrom.
Madam Chair and committee members, thanks for hearing this bill today, and thanks to Representative Welty for introducing it. My name is Dave Engstrom. I'm with Pace, Minnesota. We represent the Minnesota Association of Small Cities here at the legislature. We have 370 communities that are members of the Small Cities Association, all with less than 5,000 in membership. And all of our members are members of the League of Minnesota Cities. And I'm here today just to state my support and our organization's support for this bill. And in our board's view, this is one of those tools that we would like to see in place that helps maintain vitality in small communities.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Engstrom. Representative Welty, did you have anyone else who wanted to testify?
No.
Okay. We're going to take questions from the committee members, and Representative Lanning has one. If I may, Representative Lanning, I just want to comment at least, or ask Mr. Michael to comment about this small city TIF provision and just the history. You probably don't want to hear this, Representative Welty, but one other way to not have this disparity, the zone where the city gets it and then the 10 miles out that gets it, but in between you don't, is to not let anybody. And I know you don't want to hear that, but I do want committee members to hear the history of this provision, because that used to be the case. So just to put it in context as people think through the tax increment financing policy that surrounds this issue, if Mr. Michael could just give us a little history on it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I don't know how much detail you want on this, but the original Tax Increment Act allowed economic development districts to be used for any purpose anywhere if you could make a finding, if the city was willing to make a finding that it increased either tax base or employment. The legislature in the late 80s became concerned that tax increment for economic development purposes, since it was being used on greenfield sites, was essentially just moving development around in Minnesota, particularly with regard to retail and office type facilities. And so the response of the legislature was to eliminate completely the ability to use economic development tax increment. Keep in mind, this is different than redevelopment, where you're talking about blighted areas. The legislature in the late 80s and early 90s prohibited the use of economic development TIF for anything except manufacturing, warehousing, research and development, and in limited areas that are heavily dependent upon tourism, on tourism projects. And the concern was that, you know, retail facilities, which are very location bound, were essentially moving from one city to another based on the allowing tax increment. In response to that total disallowance, which was in effect for I don't remember exactly how long, but it may have been 4 or 5 years or more than that even, there was a concern similar to what the testifiers have expressed that cities that are along sort of in rural areas were unable to have their own services such as grocery stores and that and so forth. And so the solution was to open up economic development TIF again to uses, again here we're talking about retail office type development for those kinds of cities where it essentially was not really so much an economic development issue as providing services to the city. And the concern, of course, at the time was, well, if we allow this particularly in the metro area or in other metropolitan areas, that then you would have this disparity that the testifiers have talked about where, you know, cities that are very close to each other, one of them offers TIF because they're small, whereas the other one cannot because it's larger. And so the compromise was to settle on this arbitrary 10-mile limit, and it's clearly arbitrary, and that's sort of the situation that you're now dealing with.
Thank you, Mr. Michael. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Welty, certainly sympathetic to the arbitrariness of a 10-mile radius or whatever. I do have some concerns, however, about this provision that requires the border, that they have a contiguous border with the regional center. What my concern is, having been through countless hours of trying to mediate dispute over annexation, I see this provision, the way you've drafted it, as being an invitation for annexation disputes to develop between a regional center and a city that may be a mile or less from the border of a regional center. Have you thought about the potential of that kind of conflict arising by making it contiguous? Seems to me you're kind of inviting the possibility of annexation disputes developing as a result.
Representative Welty.
You know, Representative Lanning, just on initial thought, I wouldn't see this as an issue. Because if you are a mile away and the small city has the TIF, what's going to cause them to want to be annexed by that larger regional center? And I could see maybe your point by saying the larger regional center would want to annex the small city to get small city TIF, but they have other tools at their disposal as well. So I guess I don't necessarily see that occurring, but if you, you know, we could talk through, we could talk after committee.
Thank you. My concern is that if the regional center wants to keep a neighboring city from having this tool, they could start an annexation process that would bring their borders to a contiguous situation, and they no longer would be, that smaller city would no longer be able to offer the small city TIF. That's my question or point.
Representative Welty? Yes.
Representative, Madam Chair, we already have that situation in that as the regional city grows, its 10-mile radius grows with each annexation it does around it. That's how EOTA came into this being a few years ago at the last annexation in the city of Rochester. The city of Elgin just came into it within the last 10 years because of Rochester annexation. So you have that current situation in today's format.
Are there other questions? Is there anyone else from the public that would like to testify either for or against House File 406? Representative Welty.
Just some closing comments, Madam Chair and members of the committee. One thing I just want you to consider. I know there are people around the table who don't necessarily agree that we should have TIF. But if we're going to have TIF, then I would ask that we at least make it fair, that we allow these small cities to be able to use TIF to try to recruit or try to bring in business. There are a lot of small cities around the state of Minnesota that would be affected by this. Their local units of government have to give them the authority to use the TIF. And if they need the tools to bring in these businesses, an arbitrary 10-mile radius is challenging a lot of our communities. It's an uneven playing field. Let's at least cut down that unevenness. We don't have any resistance to this. If you want to consult all of the groups that represent cities, I would ask you to do so. But please take this into consideration. I really believe that this policy provision should pass if we're going to continue to have TIF. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Welty. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Welty, you mentioned the Association of Small Cities, and you have your testifier here, but what about the other groups representing, you know, like the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities? Is there anybody here that would speak to this?
Is there anybody who'd like to address Representative Liebling's question?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jen O'Rourke, and I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities, and we're the statewide umbrella group for all the different cities. I can't speak today for the Coalition of Cities. I don't know if they're in the room, but Representative Welty accurately explained that we've been watching this bill and working a little bit on this bill over the last 2 years to get the word out to our cities, all of our cities, and talk about any issues they may have with the bill. I know that Representative Welty amended, if you will, the first version of this bill that was out there a few years ago, and that's why you see the abutting language in the bill that's before you today.
Representative Liebling, yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, the small cities are also members of your group, right? The ones that would benefit from this.
That's correct.
Okay. Well, I guess I just would like to know about the, you know, the other groups that don't include the small cities and whether they're actively opposed to this or what their position would be.
Representative Liebling, I'll take a shot at that. I can't speak for the groups, but I would think all the groups support these provisions. I think it would be state legislators who would oppose these provisions. Some state legislators. I think what Representative Welty is doing here is, I think, really trying to address an unfairness with this zone in between. The problem, I think, for the legislature to determine is, do we want to make this tool even more expansive? Many would argue it should be gotten rid of for those that are already enjoying it now. And I think if you look at Representative Welty's bill, the summary, the estimate says 113 cities would now become eligible. Now, his next bill, which we're going to get to, is the original bill he had trying to solve a problem locally, and I think he's been fair in his first bill in trying to say he doesn't want to be selfish, and he wants, if it's good enough for Elgin, Yoda, Byron, and Orinoco, it's good enough for everybody. So I think that's kind of the difference in the bills here, but I do think there's a I don't think we'd see any of the city groups coming in and opposing this. I mean, this is authority for economic development to take place off the tax rolls. I think it's generally the tax committee who would have more concerns, but Representative Welty has been fighting for this diligently since he created chaos on the floor a couple years ago, Bill, and now he's got a statewide approach, so we appreciate that. Representative Hillstrom, did you have a point to this discussion we're having now?
I do. Yes. I just wanted to answer Representative Liebling. We actually heard this in the local government committee as well, and there was no one who came to testify in opposition.
Thank you. If there's nothing else, I'm going to lay over House File 406 and thank your testifiers, Representative Welty, and now Representative Atkins. Is he still here? Representative Atkins moves House File 919 as well, and then this is the local provision that Representative Welty has carried in the past. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I won't take up the committee's time on this. All I'll say is the bill before you right now, it just says that if you're within 10 miles of the city of Rochester, that you could qualify for a small city TIF. So this is just a local provision, but I would rather see the statewide provision be enacted because I'm all about statewide policy.
And Representative Welty, can you refresh our memory for those of us who were here when you offered this as an amendment? I believe to the public finance bill, I think Representative Abrams got upset, not about the bill particularly, but because the public finance bill was kind of agreed to and there weren't going to be changes. If I could, because I don't think Representative Demmer is here, my recollection is Representative Demmer was a strong advocate for this bill as well, and I don't want to speak for him, but I think if he were here and he is a tax committee member, he'd be fighting for your provision, and we want to, I just want to clarify for members that they know that, you know, there's been bipartisan support for your bill in the past.
There has been bipartisan support for the both bills, and actually you will see that there are a few other people who signed on around the state to the bill that we first heard as statewide provision. We have members from the Brainerd area, the Austin area, the Albert Lea area that have signed on as well. So with that, the one for Rochester, though, Representative Demmer offered that to Representative Abrams' bill. Yeah, on the House floor. It was not me.
It wasn't you who was the troublemaker. Sorry, let's correct the record there.
So now I'm advocating for Demmer's bill, which is a very bipartisan
piece of okay. Thank you for that clarification, Representative Welty, and I know Representative Demmer would be assisting you now if he were here. Are there questions for Representative Welty on the specific provision for these cities? If not, I will lay over House File 919, and thank you, Representative Welty.
Appreciate
thank
you for your time. I know how much time the members of the Tax Committee have been putting in. You've had a number of bills, and I just want to thank you.
Thank you. And we are going to go to Representative Knuth, House File 1672. Would someone like to move Representative Knuth's bill? Representative Hilstrom moves House File 1672. And then Representative Clark, I think, is... Everybody's busy. She's kind of been in and out. If she comes in again, we'll get to her next. Representative Knuth, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 1672 really is a bill about a redevelopment project up along 35W in New Brighton that would have some pretty big consequences in terms of jobs and housing and all sorts of good things in the Twin Cities metro area. It's a pretty prime location, 20 minutes from either downtown, and a lot of work has been done, and we've run into some problems with geotechnical peat soil is the layman's version of what we've run into in a place where we have to do some remediation and cleanup anyway, and so we're trying to figure out some ways to help address some of those issues, and I have some people from the city who can address it much more eloquently than I can.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, council members, I'm Steve Larson. I'm the mayor of New Brighton.
Mr. Mayor.
Pleasure to be here.
You're used to being on at your city council. You just call us city council members.
Commissioner. I've been on emails all day with a big issue that's coming up tomorrow night, and I've been emailing
yes.
support to everybody.
So nice to see you, Mr. Mayor.
I've been days. But it is indeed our pleasure to be here. Wish it was under better circumstances. We were faced in January with the facts of all of a sudden having a shortfall of about $5.5 million approximately on a project in Northwest Quadrant. It's the intersection of 684 and 35W. And unfortunately, we found the peat that the Representative Knuth has talked about underneath the solvent. Time up already. What we found is that in order for us to remove the old solvent factory residue and refinery that was on the site, we also would have to remove about 30 feet of peat underneath it. The NPCA let us know that, and our costs all of a sudden doubled for remediation. And we have a lot of history dealing with Superfund sites. The site district, TIF district number 26, was the old McGibbles-Gibbs site, which had all kinds of problems with arsenic and solvents. So what we did is work with EPA and NPCA on that issue, and what we're trying to do is now use some of the pooling that would be available in about another 6-7 years out of that district to try to cover some of the shortfalls that we're going to be faced with because of the new geotechnical problems that we're going to have to address. We have no choice in the matter. We're going to be good stewards of our community and of our state. We probably should take care of this issue before it goes into a regional park as well as could go into Long Lake, if it goes in Long Lake, which has already found a sampling of trichloroethylene, and then it goes into Rice Creek, which goes into Mississippi. So I think we would be remiss if we did not take care of the problem now as it exists.
Thank you, Mayor Larson. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dean Lauder, City Manager of the City of New Brighton. Thank you, Madam Chair, and the committee members for the opportunity to appear before you today. Not wanting to repeat necessarily the points that Mayor Larson's already made, but this project is unique in respect to the fact that we have known about the contamination issues on the site for many years. It's the peat. You'll hear the term geotechnical issues, but it's really muck, basically, that we found that is causing some of our problems. We do have cleanup issues on this site, but I guess what I would like to at least share with you are my thoughts that this project is a winner for the City of New Brighton, but also for the state of Minnesota. And any assistance that we would receive from the state of Minnesota in making this project a successful and fruitful one, the state will see the benefits of that for years to come. Our estimates right now with current market values is that once the project is completely built out, the state of Minnesota would see about $500,000 a year in tax revenue every year. So you can see that over the life of the project that would yield a windfall of money for the state as well. We do look forward to constructing about 700 to 900 homes there. The office and industrial that would be built in that area would produce about 2,000 to 2,500 jobs. So this is a very important project for not just the city, but we believe for the state as well, and we ask for your support.
Thank you. Representative Knuth, other comments?
I think the representatives from the city put it well, and thanks for hearing our testimony.
Are there questions for Representative Knuth or the testifiers? Or is there anyone from the public who would like to testify for or against this bill? Representative Knuth, I've just been trying to think about your problem here a little bit, and I won't even guess what might be a solution here, but it seems to me that you've got the TIF district, and we have a history of the five-year knockdown rule being passed by, but the pooling concept is difficult for this committee, and it seems that you kind of had the rug pulled out from underneath you with the extra remediation costs, and you're just looking for the money. So I don't know, I won't guess what the TIF working group will come up with as to how there might be able to be assistance, but I guess I would just ask for to think through flexibility, try to be flexible here and not prescriptive in what might help get you to the appropriation, because we have had a long history of not really violating much in the way of pooling, and I know this is just New Brighton's attempt to try to get the money. I don't know if you have any reaction to that, or if the mayor does, but the committee wants to always try to limit how many of these exceptions take place for pooling.
Madam Chair, Commission members, I understand totally where you come from. When we were informed of this situation on the 17th of January, I guess everybody in that room was shocked. It's a major issue. We've always tried to, in the past 20-some years, working with ours and all tax, our tax increment districts are all redevelopment issues. We don't have clean soils. We're redeveloping old property or 120 years old. And we've had a lot of uses that had the contamination related to it. So we're always remediating, and it's something we're used to doing. We just weren't used to getting hit with the added price tag. And I think what COLI is going to allow us to do is to make sure that none of the property taxpayers in our citizen, or in our community, especially the senior citizens that we have, will ever have to pay for any of the cleanup that we have to do. If we can use COLI to do it, it will not have to be paid for by property taxes. And I think that's our hope, that we can avoid having anybody have to pay for it. Otherwise, you know, if the pooling isn't available, then we have to find someplace else to come up with it.
Thank you, Mayor Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for pointing that out. And like you said, we're trying a few different things in the legislature this year, and this is one of them and an important piece. And I would welcome talking with you and figuring out the best way to do it.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Another testifier, welcome.
Madam Chair, I'm Jim Casserly from Craftsman Row.
And we assist the city with its financial and legal analysis for economic development and redevelopment. Let me just point out what the context is here. What this pooling would allow is to cover about maybe 50 to 60% of the shortfall that we're now incurring. The shortfall is really a result of changes that have occurred in 2002. And we lost about 20 to 25% of our redevelopment funding. And that's just because of class rate changes and other things that the state has done. And it really created some dilemmas for us even back then. What has compounded it, and you'll hear some more testimony about this on other matters that will be coming before you today, what has compounded it is the very difficult nature of trying to put together a project of this size. And in addition, the extreme geotechnical issues that we ran into. We have some issues also dealing with a city landfill. It's not a city landfill, a landfill that's on the other side of Old Highway 8. That's part of this entire district. So, Madam Chair and members, this really is a very, very difficult issue for us. If we could find any other mechanism to get funds, If we have requests in to other committees for appropriations, we are looking for money out of bonding bills. We are all over the place. We're at the feds. We are everywhere, and we are trying to find money. This is simply an ability. This would allow us to use some of our own resources that would be coming to us in the years 2019 through 2023. So that's really what's going on here.
Thank you, Mr. Casterly. Other questions? Anyone else from the public? If not, Representative Hillstrom renews her motion for House File 1672, and I will lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Knuth. And Representative Clark is next, who has said Representative Atkins can go ahead of her, but Representative Mullery is ahead of Representative Atkins. So, Representative Mullery, do you cede your time to Representative Atkins?
Yes, Madam Chair.
No, he created huge problems for me last week in our committee by not signing things. As long as we get on this afternoon, because both witnesses can't come back tonight.
Okay. Representative Atkins. Representative Atkins moves House Bill 1808.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be brief. This is a TIF provision, as you might expect. When a TIF district is adopted, there's all kinds of public hearing and notice requirements that folks go through, and that's appropriate. When they're modified, there's all kinds of public hearing and notice requirements that you go through. But certain modifications, or maybe I should say it, not all modifications are built alike. There's some that are significant that ought to go through a very serious process. There's others that are not quite so significant that can be done in a more abbreviated fashion. The reason, Madam Chair, that this one is so important is because we're missing out on some opportunities, specifically with regard to affordable housing projects. We've got, this was brought to me by the Dakota County Community Development Agency, and what's happening is that as pieces become available, you know, first you've got this piece here, and you want to add a piece or something like that. As additional pieces become available, this process that we're forcing folks to go through is adding about 3 or 4 months to the process. By the time you go through that process, just a modification, not a new TIF project altogether, but a mere modification, the piece is now gone, the additional piece that was set to be acquired. So this, in a very limited setting, allows for a more abbreviated, quick process. And that is where it consists of one or more parcels under common ownership. It's acquired from a willing seller, and it's acquired for purposes of development of as a housing project. There's still a process, there's still notice, there's still lots of opportunity for folks to be involved in it and say whether or not they object or not, but you don't have to go through this 4-month-long or 3.5-month-long situation. And frankly, by the time you do, oftentimes that additional piece or modification is no longer even available. I think it makes a great deal of sense. As you know, I'm not a huge fan of making TIF easier, but if we're going to have it in place, we may as well make it workable, and particularly for folks that are doing things like the Community Development Agency in its efforts to provide more affordable housing. I do have a witness here for questions, but otherwise I think it's just very straightforward and simple. And if there are questions, I'd be happy to address them. Otherwise, that's all I got.
Thank you. Are there questions from Representative Atkins? Is the person who came, they're just here for questions, or if they want to testify, now is the time? Just questions. Okay. Anybody from the committee, questions on this piece? Anyone from the public, either for or against? Well, Representative Atkins was right. He was going to be fast. So I will lay over House File 1808 for Possible Inclusion in the Omnibus Tax Bill. Thank you, Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, appreciate your time.
Thank you. And Representative Clark, are you ready now? Or is she? There she is. I just didn't see it right there. Sorry about that. Would someone like to move Representative Clark's bill?
Thank you.
Representative Mullery moves House File 822. Welcome to the committee, Representative Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. And I do have some handouts, if I could ask the stage to hand them out, please. And I have to apologize, Madam Chair. One of them is a letter to you that's only copied on one side, so I think you already got the letter from Mr. Fong at Harvard. Did you get that letter? Anyway, hope so.
Mr. Fong, that's right.
I can...
Are there other pages who can help Representative Clark? And Representative Clark, if you need anything copied there, a page can go copy and distribute it.
Okay. I hope this is them. There we go. Hopefully I haven't got too much. Yeah. Okay, Madam Chair members, the bill that's before you is a bill to try to continue the commitment to a program that was established in Minneapolis called the Neighborhood Revitalization Program. And it came out of just kind of a desperate situation that a lot of our neighborhoods were in some 20 years ago. And it basically is a program that used tax increment financing to do neighborhood revitalization, as the name entitles. And it was unique in that it gave the money through a neighborhood-based community decision-making process. And so what you have before you is an effort to try to continue that process. The commitment was made that there would be $400 million, $20 million a year for 20 years. And what has happened is that commitment has not yet been fulfilled, partly because of changes in tax law that reduced the increment that was coming from the common fund that was mentioned in this bill. So what we ask here is that the existing Neighborhood Revitalization Policy Board look at the situation and come back next year with some recommendations on how we can keep that commitment so that the neighborhoods can continue their fabulous work of revitalizing the neighborhoods throughout the city. And I guess what I'd like to do is I have one witness who has to be over in the Senate in a couple of minutes. If that would be okay, I'd like to ask Mr. Graham to go first. And then I'm finding there's numerous people in the neighborhood, in numerous neighborhoods, and what I might ask them to do is just come down and stand. I want to just have a few of them testify, if that would be okay, Madam Chair.
That'd be great.
Okay.
Awesome.
So anybody who's here for the NRP bill, please come on down.
Madam Chair, committee members, in 1997, the Ventura Village, then it was part of the Phillips neighborhood, asked to be declared a national disaster area because of blight and crime. The city, the county, the state was spending millions of dollars on services because of that blight. When that request was made, it made international and national news in the Washington Post, the Washington Times, Dallas Morning News, and other national and international publications. The neighborhood did not get that relief. It needed to do something. What it did instead was take $70,000 of NRP dollars and do a community-based planning process and started recruiting development for that area. Since that time, it has created $133 million in development and may well create another $200 million in development around the Franklin area. At the time of that NRP was done, the city of Minneapolis and Hennepin County had a plan done and had a feasibility study, and they said the possibility of any development on Franklin Avenue was bleak. And that's a direct quote. The neighborhood, of course, didn't think it was bleak, so they went ahead and used that $70,000 as the seeds to create that money. The tax dollars that have come from that, I am sure, far exceed any dollars that have come into that particular area of the city. In addition, it has relieved costs for the county, the city, and the state of Minnesota for other social service dollars that would have been there. All of that, regardless of the human suffering that would have been there. To give an example, when we started doing the planning, I said before the planning is done in 6 months, every house in the community will be worth an additional $25,000 because of the perceptions of the area. People said I was crazy and I was lying. And I was, quite honestly, not lying, just crazy. Because before we were finished with the planning part, every house was worth $70,000 more. Houses that you could not sell for $40,000 at that time now bring $250,000 to $300,000. That's what NRP has done. And remember, this was an area that the city, the county, and other people said there was no hope for. An area that was called the Black Zone because it should be bulldozed and nothing else done. And now the media calls it the Miracle on Franklin. That miracle happened because community people could take their money, which I consider tax dollars to be, and spend it in a way that was most beneficial and effective in their community. And that's NRP. If you fund any money for the city of Minneapolis, fund NRP because it'll be more wisely spent than any other dollars. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I did not catch your name. Can you give
My name is Jim Graham. I live at 2101 10th Avenue. And in the heart of what once was the drug industry, and you, now, then you could have 30, 40 drug dealers a block. Now you can't find one if you really wanted one.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you. And to other testifiers who are here to speak to Representative Clarksville, we want to get you a chair. I feel uncomfortable watching you stand. There's a chair there. There's these chairs right here. Please, welcome. But you shouldn't have to stand through the hearing. So if you can find it, we can pull these chairs that are around the first two here too, because we do want to have you join us. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Our story, and I come from the Jordan neighborhood in Minneapolis, which is one of the largest concentrations of poverty in Hennepin County.
Excuse me, can I get you to tell us?
My name is Dorothy Titus. I'm sorry, Dottie Titus.
Thank you.
And we are still a work in progress, but we have made such huge strides, it's unbelievable. We have a community that was abandoned by the city, by everybody, and basically left. It was our place was a lot like, you know, the not in my backyard syndrome, where offenders came and lived, and nobody did an awful lot about it. We started our NRP program by identifying the Dirty 30, the houses that were the biggest problems in the neighborhood. We went on to get all of those houses either demolished, rehabbed, new houses built, and today it's a very different process. We have citizens that are highly engaged. We have a community garden that stands on what was one of the heaviest drug-dealing corners in the city. But we've done more. And I think Jim spoke eloquently to the kinds of leveraging that has happened throughout the city with the financial dollars. Jordan has done something similar. Neighborhoods bring an ability to raise funds that the cities don't have and or can't use to the extent we can. Over a 28-month period, for example, in our neighborhood, our NRP organization, our neighborhood organization, brought in $330,000 worth of grant money. We do that because we have an organization that is partly funded by NRP. We have brought into the city intellectual capital that is leveraged. Instead of the city having a small planning department, they have 81 departments, one in every single neighborhood in the city. We have come up with creative and innovative ways to make changes to improve our neighborhoods and improve the city overall. We have also leveraged just the intellectual capacity. In Jordan neighborhood, for example, we were not content with the city's standards for rehabbing and infill housing. We wrote our own, and today those standards are part of the city code. So there is a lot that we bring as organizations. We work with the city. We work well with the cities. And I think NRP is one of the most amazing programs. I moved back here recently from the East Coast where nothing like this exists, where people just shake their heads at the fact that the government does everything and you don't have a voice in it, you don't know what's going on. And there is an aliveness in this city that is very different. And in this area, because of things like this, where people can get involved, where they know they have a voice, where they know they're heard. And so I would certainly urge you to continue. What we struggle with in Jordan is the promise is not fulfilled yet. The funding was cut. We all know 9/11 and an economic downturn hurt everybody. But we, for example, put 99.9% of our funding into housing in the first phase with the intention that in phase two, we could now address the needed economic development and other things that needed to happen to complete the transformation of our neighborhood. We have not been able to do that because of funding cuts. And everybody who is familiar with the crime situation in North Minneapolis knows that a lot of this is about jobs, about providing economic opportunity. We need NRP to continue so that we can get those fundings and make that a reality. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Titus. And I see we have at least five more testifiers, so we're going to...
I'll be fine.
Please, for the testimony, and then we'll do
thank
five.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay,
that's fine, Madam Chair, and they won't all necessarily have to testify.
Oh, that's
identify
fine.
Where they're from.
Thank you.
Thanks, Madam Chair. My name is Carol Pass, and I live in East Phillips, 2536 18th Avenue South. I'm the chair of East Phillips, and I'm on the policy board. And I don't know who has what. I didn't mean to be so confusing about handing these things out, but I just wanted to... Do you all have this copy of this?
Yes.
Okay.
We have it.
I want to call attention to the red and blue dots. That is the east side of Phillips, and those places, the vacants are just vacant, and the boarded are also vacant and boarded. You can see that probably almost no one can live on many of those blocks, and that's the way it was in 99 when we got our funding on that side of Phillips. I want it, since this is a tax and finance committee, I want folks here to think about the loss in terms of tax revenue with those houses and to consider the fact that we filled almost all those vacant lots. All those places are bringing in taxes now, and they aren't pulling out police dollars at, what is it, about 70 bucks a visit. Those places, you could imagine, they were primarily prostitutes, pimps, and drug dealers. And I know, Madam, sorry, you heard my speech. However, I think this is very serious. If you add up the dollars here of income versus outgo and versus damage to the community. The other things I wanted you to see, this is an example of one of those blocks. You can see all the boarded buildings, vacant land, no taxes coming in, nothing but crime. Up here is an apartment building that we built with the beginnings of NRP. We hired our own architect and got our developer, put up our money, drew them in, used this to leverage other dollars. And so now, this is right near Bloomington and Lake, where the city invested significant dollars in the Mercado, which was beginning to fail. So we not only saved or brought in tax dollars with this, but also really saved the businesses there and brought in more business, kept the businesses, saved the city investment. So, and in addition, these are homeowner situations, more desolate, boarded and vacant buildings, more crime, more people leaving the area, and we filled this all in with housing. We have also 26 units of housing that are just single-family homes dotted throughout the area in those vacant lots. Now, as verification, I mean, I'm just talking money, because I think that's what's at issue here to some extent. If you will look at this chart goes from 19, it's the Phillips homeowner and rental vacancy rate. You can see in 1980, there's almost a 45-degree trajectory going up given the vacant and boarded housing. You can see that this area of the city was just failing. If it had continued to go on at this rate, we simply wouldn't have anybody there at all. And that's the way it was when we started with NRP. We could not make a dent in this without just pinpointing each place. This was something local people had to do. And you can see how when I saw this, I was stunned. I mean, I knew it was good, but I didn't know it was that good. Then there's a 45-degree angle in the opposite direction. These are tax dollars coming in. There are homeowners coming in. There are vacancy rates going down. This means more money, less hassle for the city. This means people not leaving. It means everything, jobs, and et cetera. And I can see that this one, median home values, you can see we peak here, we drop, the city is going backward. This is 1980, this is 1990, and the home values are dropping. And then they start to go up again. But, you know, the interesting thing, I was thinking about this, and I was thinking, well, even if the median home value is, there's also way more homes. So it's not just median home values, it's the fact that there's way more homes bringing in more dollars. So if you combine those two, this chart and that chart together mean a huge influx of money and of safe streets that we didn't have before. And my last chart here is the poverty status of families with kids under 18. Makes a big difference. It, again, is skyrocketing, and then NRP begins in Phillips, and it starts to drop. Now, if you look at the last chart, this is who's here in Phillips. This is a big area. It's now four neighborhoods. It's huge. It's almost the whole near south side. And basically, we have an enormous number of refugees, immigrants, and it's 80% minority. These are the people who do work, build the houses, lift the, you know, do all this hard work in the city. And I just want to say, you can see that the poverty, that people are moving toward living in poverty more and more. 1990, when NRP starts to move, it starts to drop. And I, you know, I'm just saying that however you decide to fund this, however this goes on, this makes so much financial sense, and it actually accounts for this area is, Barry Schiff tells me that this area is the area that has increased the population in Minneapolis. If we don't do this, this chart is going to go the other direction. I'm convinced of it. We're struggling now. We do not want to see in another 10 years, we don't want to see this whole thing have another 45 degree in the opposite direction. At least we want to plateau and stay the same. So I'm asking you to figure this out for us.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Clark, did you have others who would like to testify?
I think I'll ask a few people just to introduce themselves in the neighborhood.
Yes, welcome.
Hi, my name is Debbie Evans. I live in the Linden Hills neighborhood at 3807 Zenith Avenue South. If some of the warm fuzzies may not appeal, living in Linden Hills, NRP is not a necessary, is not a requirement. But we also recognize that for the city as a whole and my own neighborhood to thrive, it's required for the neighborhoods, the middle class neighborhoods and the struggling neighborhoods. If the warm fuzzies don't appeal, the recognition that well over $500 million in leverage is what's come from the NRP investment, and the challenges that we have with tax dollars, not to have to come up with that $500 million, have those neighborhoods on a grassroots level be able to access those, saves all of us money and effort and having to be here. Thank you.
And may I ask you, just can you tell us your name again for the tape? Was it Gavin?
Debbie Evans.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Welcome.
Hi, I'm Ken Kulash. I sit on the policy board. I'm a labor representative. I live in a Kenny neighborhood in southwest Minneapolis. It's a very nice neighborhood, one of the safest in the city. We have an NRP committee, or a neighborhood organization, and that organization does what it does consistently throughout the city, and what I've watched throughout the city is that it takes a big city and puts it into small towns, small little neighborhoods. The neighbors get to know each other. That little committee puts on festivals, local newsletter, finds out what the neighborhood needs, and goes out and asks questions of the neighborhood. That information comes back and becomes a plan. That plan can consist of the bricks and mortar, or it can consist of doing other things, parks. Can consist of cleanup day, consist of recording the history of the neighborhoods, and so on and so forth. NRP has had a unique ability to do that when you've got an impersonal city that's huge, overwhelming, and trying to get something to the city, overwhelming. We weren't able to do stuff like that. The neighborhoods weren't able to do anything. The city had the final say. Once the neighborhood organizations through the statutory requirements that came out of this body said that neighborhoods have to decide what's going on with the money in their neighborhoods. The statutes say all money has to go through neighborhood action plans, and because of that, when the city wants to do something, when a developer wants to do something, the neighborhoods have a little clout that says, we'd like you to do it this way because this is what our neighborhood needs. And that has been an amazing accomplishment. It has brought in hundreds of thousands of volunteer hours into a city where there's annual cleanup days, there's annual festivals, there's annual garage sales, and you can go on and on. Each neighborhood has created its own. Those are the kinds of things that a neighborhood organization and the ability to have some funding make happen. So I hope you can support this and continue the funding for NRP. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kielash. Other testifiers, welcome.
I think this will be our last person to speak, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
I'm Don Anderson of the Wyndham Park Neighborhood Association in Northeast Minneapolis. I'm currently chair of the NRP committee, and I've been with the NRP program since its inception, back before it was actually organized. I feel very strongly about the NRP program and what it has done for our neighborhood. We have improved our housing to the extent that we can't imagine what could have been done otherwise. Sometimes when we think of funding, we think of the money that's being spent by the city, for instance, in supporting the NRP program. But we have to look at the other side of the coin. The fact that the improvements that have been done in our neighborhood, for instance, has increased the tax base for the city of Minneapolis at a point where perhaps, I don't have the charts with me at this point, but the fact is that there's more money coming back into the city coffers because of the NRP funding that has been spent in our neighborhood. And I urge you to continue the funding continuously for the full period of time that you're talking about right now. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson, for that. Representative Mullery has a question. Representative Earhart, but I think Representative Simpson's been waiting. I just want to double check. Was there any other testifiers first?
I just have a resource person in case there's some questions.
Okay, and I see there's a representative from the city of Minneapolis here as well, so I don't know if they want to testify. But to Representative Simpson, unless you were right on that point, Representative Mullery. Representative Simpson's been on the list for a while. Representative Simpson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. It's pretty compelling testimony by all these people of the progress that's been made and the things that are doing. They're not asking for funding in this bill, so why doesn't the city of Minneapolis or Hennepin County just do this? Why does the legislature have to be brought into this? The testimony certainly indicates success, so this is a study. Can't the city do it or the Hennepin County?
Representative Clark, did you want to answer? I have an answer to that as well, but Representative Clark.
Membership members, and I see Representative Mulley probably wants to chime in too. You know, certainly our city and our kind of the stakeholders in this can all come together. And in fact, the NRP board, policy board, includes a number of stakeholders, the city, the county, the school board, so on. But we want to get this going. And if we don't, part of this NRP was created by state law, by state statute. And so we want to recognize where this came from and continue that partnership with the state. And there may be, depending on the recommendations, something that we ask to continue in terms of the tax increment findings. Maybe not. But we want the state to be a partner with us in case we do come with that direction or another that we're right at the table.
And Representative Mullery has a point on that too, but Representative Simpson, I'll tell you my view why it's here, and that is because there is a state cost to this bill. It is tax increment financing, and legislators that sit on this committee know that that means that there are different things happening for us in the state when we allow tax increment financing. Now, in my personal opinion, and I've shared this with Representative Clark and Representative Dabney, and I've spoken with Mr. Ranieri, who's here from the city of Minneapolis, and I've read articles, and I'm trying to figure out the Minneapolis position, and my take is that Minneapolis legislators aren't quite sure how they want to proceed on this, so I'd like this as a study, but this is going to end in 2009, so that this legislature or the next must make this decision as to whether or not to let this go forward. And at what level, or to let it expire as it was intended. And I have looked at some preliminary information from the city of Minneapolis, and for the committee's perspective, for example, if these tax increment financing districts were allowed to expire as was originally contemplated in the law, there would be less LGA payments going to the city of Minneapolis. That is a direct cost by keeping these property taxes off the tax rolls. So the legislature is doing more there. There's also fiscal disparity issues there, and Mr. Ranieri for the city of Minneapolis has provided me with, and I'm sure would provide it to the whole committee, a PowerPoint presentation that I think was given to the Minneapolis City Council, and I think that the committee itself will need even further information than has been provided to date to really understand what the pros and cons are. I think Representative Clark has seen the direct benefit of infusions of resources into certain parts of the city, and it's very foreign to all of us who don't represent Minneapolis because none of us has a TIF district like this. This is very different. They have citizen representatives who make both elected and non, making decisions on these resources, and it's sort of a rolling TIF. And I fear, you know, I think the legislature does need to understand that this is our call. We want to get more input from Minneapolis, and I'd like to hear from Representative Mohler and Dabney what they're thinking in their city, because I think all of us are struggling to understand what all legislators in Minneapolis want, what the city council wants, and I appreciate the testimony we've heard to date, and I got to hear it in local government as well, and I can understand why people want this program to continue, but there is a state cost to the program. Representative Mohler.
Well, Madam Chair, first of all, as I think Madam Chair knows, not always all legislators from a city always agree and always agree with their city. I think
I've got a TIF district, too.
Well,
yes, I've got a big TIF district in Bloomington.
I was just going to say, I think it's Representative Downey said, especially from if you're from Minneapolis, but I think especially if you're from Bloomington also.
Yeah.
Just briefly, I think the fiscal disparities effect is pretty minimal when I looked into it, but I think most people don't understand that in 1991, the state committed to this program that there'd be $400 million to this program to revitalize the neighborhoods. Then, in 2001, they took away the funding sources, both the change in the educational funding and the change in the commercial, et cetera, class rates by the state are what totally cut off all of the funding sources, or most of the funding sources that had been committed by the state. So the state, in essence, went back on its commitment completely on that. And just, there's been a lot said about this, but I think that people don't understand how important this program is. I spent an hour and a half talking to the head of the Department of Neighborhoods, which is a large department in Los Angeles. And they're a big enough city that they have a separate Department of Neighborhoods. And he said that he's gone all across the country to all the major cities, and nowhere did they have anything at all like this, where it's so effective, run by citizens, and the tremendous amount of citizen input into revitalization of the city that's going on. And I just think it would be really tragic to let that go down right now when there's a lot of parts of Minneapolis that are desperate and in need of revitalization and the things that are provided by this program. And in turn, the state gets a lot out of it, because I think if you look into it, the amount of taxes that come back from these, the lessening of the services required and things like that from the state, all help the state financially in the long run far more than the money going into it.
Thank you, Representative Mohler. Representative Dabney, I don't know if you want to comment. I do want to hear from Mr. Michael, maybe could tell us, or Mr. Hines, if he's here, just a guesstimate even, as to the two effects that Representative Mohler cited, which are correct, the CI compression and the 2001 takeover of the state channel ed levy, of that original $400 million that was supposed to happen in the city of Minneapolis, how much was lost, what percentage of that. It would be good to, before the end of this, if we could get a guesstimate number. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Simpson hit it on the head. It's compelling testimony because there are compelling stories across the city. Before I was elected, living in the Seward neighborhood, I was very active on the Seward Neighborhood Group Board, which is the NRP group in that neighborhood, and we used, I don't know how much money, I forget, it's been long enough, to do everything from assist loans to homeowners looking to improve their homes, to assistance in redevelopment efforts, to community festivals, all the sorts of things that folks testified to. I've now moved to the Longfellow neighborhood just to the south, but the story is much the same there and across the city. Carol, Ms. Pass was right, and Mr. Graham, the changes along Franklin Avenue are stunning. I've lived along that stretch at times in the past. I knew it in the bad old days. And now you drive down and it's like you don't recognize it. This can't possibly be the same place that I'm not going to say hung out on, because suddenly that has some negative connotations, but lived off of, how's that, 20 years ago. So it is striking stuff. There is a lot of conversation to be had, given, you know, Representative Mallory's comments are absolutely right. The state really did blast a fairly large hole below the waterline in terms of the funding for this program, and how do we then move forward and fund these opportunities? How do we fund the citizen involvement, which may or may not be the same thing? There's lots of questions out there with, I think it's 2009 looming.
Thank you for that. I don't know if Mr. Ranieri wants to address us, or if Mr. Michael wants to take a shot at that, or someone, a price tag.
Can I also ask if Mr. Miller could make a couple comments? Please.
Sure, and we'll get to that too. And Representative Earhart has a question as well. But I do think, and Representative Clark already heard me say this in local government, but for Representative Dabney, my kids play soccer at the Y on Franklin and Lake, and I am very aware of what's happened in this area as I pick a different restaurant to eat on Lake Street every Sunday. And it really, things are really turning around there, and I do spend a lot of time in that area, at Lake and Franklin. In the map we're looking at.
We were trying to figure out how you found a Y at Franklin and Lake Street, since they're parallel.
You know, we think of it from how light rail works. We're coming from Bloomington.
Or is this that thing where the earth curves eventually?
But for those who are not in these areas, and this Representative Clark has brought a map of one community, but members in the legislature should know this is affecting all of Minneapolis, all neighborhoods across Minneapolis. But it is certainly true that you can see that things are really changing, and I can understand why your constituents would want to see this continue. Is Mr. Michael or Mr. Ranieri, could you give us a number on what you think the state, and I should say this compression question and the loss of TIF revenues due to school levy takeover happened to every TIF district in the state of Minnesota. All 2,000 of them are feeling these effects, and all of them, including the TIF districts in my city, are coming forward and asking for the state to assist them in that regard. But I think it is helpful for us to hear what percentage of that $400 million may have been lost due to the 2001 reform.
Can I ask a couple of questions? So in case anybody out there has got any numbers,
sure,
that they can come forth and...
Sure, Representative Earhart.
Madam Chair, I don't really understand this thing. Where does the NRP money come from? Is the whole city a TIF district? That's what it sounds like. It really does. The state involvement, what's the state involvement in this? You talk about grants and loans. Are they loans to the homeowners? What's the whole finance background on this, I think?
Representative Earhart, that's a great point. We're going to have Mr. Michael talk to us for a few minutes here.
Okay.
On how did NRP come to be? What's the TIF component? Is all of Minneapolis the TIF district? He can answer those questions. Mr. Michael.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm not really prepared to give the detail of the NRP history. It's a long and involved history. All of Minneapolis is not a TIF district, Representative Earhart. The situation was, just to give the, you know, a 5-cent sort of history of this, that Minneapolis did a couple of refundings as the part of the second refunding of its TIF districts, which involved sort of pooling revenues from all of those to reduce the combined debt service cost of those districts. And the upshot of that was that the legislature, as a result of a long negotiation that involved Representative Clark and a variety of other legislators, many of whom are no longer in the legislature at the time, essentially created or enacted the NRP program as part of that, and it involved the flexibility to spend their increments on more things than what normally would be. And it was funded largely with surplus increments, in part that was generated from debt service funding, and in part was just by fiat to sort of dictate that some of the city's surplus increments be allocated to NRP. And it also involved this sort of, as some of the testifiers have indicated, this sort of complicated and involved community involvement in how the decisions are made as to how that money is to be spent. There were a series of changes in the underlying tax system that generate increments that occurred through the starting in 1997 legislative session when we began to compress tax classification rates, and culminating in the 2001 tax reform, which took away the education levy and sort of completed the compression that reduced the amount of surplus increments that the city had available to it, because always the city has to meet its debt service obligations to bondholders. And so that, you know, sort of in part, I don't know the details of the financing. The people from Minneapolis probably can talk more about it, but it's very, you know, disentangling exactly how far close they came to the projection of $400 million, which was sort of just a loose projection at the time. There are probably multiple complicated explanations for that, but that's the sort of the 5-second explanation of the real full dollar story.
Thank you. Did you get your answers there?
Well, sort of, Madam Chair, but I was just wondering, because there's been a shortage of money for police and maybe fire in there, if all this stuff is impairing the ability of the city to perform some of its basic functions. They seem to be having a heck of a time meeting increased police department, for instance.
Perhaps I'm on.
Madam Chair, just to Mr. Michaels' point about the 97, I believe, though, that it was $20 million a year was the in the law, and they didn't have trouble with that, getting that from the 97 changes or the 98 changes. It wasn't until the 2001 changes when it brought such a collapse that there was no longer that much money.
Thank you. And maybe the city will be able to provide us more information on that later. And we do want to hear
Mr. Miller,
probably. Your other testifier and Mr. Ranieri. Is it Mr. Miller?
Yes.
Welcome to the committee. And members, I know that we have a lot of bills today, and I know it's a long agenda. It goes into the night. And I know people want to get to their bills. But members have to think about this, whether they want to or not. This is not a local bill. This is a big $400 million TIF bill, and it was created by Minnesota law, and the Minneapolis delegation is going to be spending a lot of time thinking about this, and we need to think about it too. So I do want folks to feel that they can get their testimony in on this provision. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bob Miller. I'm the director of the Minneapolis Neighborhood Revitalization Program. I also have a little bit of other involvement in it, and I helped start one of the neighborhood organizations that actually was formed because of NRP. And I've had plenty of opportunity to involve myself with just about every neighborhood out there. When NRP began, Mr. Michaels is absolutely correct. I mean, this was basically a deal that the state forced. It was the legislature that made this commitment work. It did that because of the fact that they had some concerns about the refunding that occurred, and they said, we want to have some ideas what this is going to be spent on. There's a lot of things in that bill, though, that are pretty ingenious. I mean, frankly, you basically asked people to take responsibility for themselves and for their community. And you said you're going to have some resources to invest. And I want to tell you, this is not a giveaway program. This is an investment program. And Representative Earhart's absolutely correct. You know, why should you do this? Well, I'll tell you. You think about what would have happened had this not been done. If these investments hadn't been made, they made up for a lot of the deferred work that hadn't occurred over the previous 10, 15, 20 years. There was a loss of population occurring in the city of Minneapolis. There was also a lot of concern about the status of the boarded and vacant buildings and the housing stock in the city. We have invested in over 8,000 loans in the city of Minneapolis. We have done grants through the neighborhoods. We have invested in businesses. Take a look at McLeod Avenue. If you want to see what happens, Look at Nicollet Avenue from Franklin all the way down to 28. That would never have happened if it hadn't been for one little neighborhood called Stevens Square, which said, if that street continues to die, we're dead. And they were the ones who put up money when the city had said we were going to do a million overlay, and that's all we're going to do. They were the ones who said, we cannot have that happen because we've got this opportunity, we've got to take advantage of it. And so, 39 residents and some businesses worked for 4 years on a plan for completely redoing Nicollet Avenue. And that meant from facade to facade. That's why the street lights look the way they do. That's why the sidewalk looks the way it does. That's why there's trees there. That's why there's pedestrian lighting. And that's why there's businesses there now. And so the 24% vacancy rate that they had at the point in time when they started that project dropped down to almost zero. And now you've got businesses who bought the buildings because they've made that commitment. And now you've got the convention center, which takes buses down there to Eat Street, and that's the advertisement. In 2001, all of this changed. It was not a decision of the city. It was not a decision of the neighborhoods. When the legislature changed the rules in 2001, the income that came in from those tax increment districts dropped. It went from $126 million that was expected in 2001 to $50 million in 2002. That killed the ability of the neighborhoods to really benefit from the investment that had been occurring. And it stopped people almost dead in their tracks. And I cannot tell you the impact that that had. For 3 years, we didn't have any idea of where we were going to be or what was going to happen. And so neighborhoods stopped investing back in the neighborhood because they didn't know whether or not they're going to have any resources in the future. When we were able to reestablish it, yes, we reestablished it at a lower level, but we were still able to give people some resources to invest, and I think that's what made a difference there. The legislature started this program, but I will tell you that, you know, on Thursday of this week, I have a delegation coming in of 13 people from Russia. They are coming here to hear about this program. That's their only reason for being here. My staff has spoken with more than 80 countries, people from over 80 countries around the world who come in for this program. We were identified as one of the 100 best practices in urban environments by the Habitat Conference, too. And that was a competition, and we didn't seek it out. And so, I mean, this is a very unique program. And if anything, what the state should look at is how can you expand this and make the same opportunity available to cities that are smaller than the cities of the first class. Because a Rochester, a St. Cloud, a city of those natures who is just starting out can use this as a way of building a future. So that's one of the things I really would encourage you to think about as you look at this bill. It's not just about Minneapolis. It has been restricted to them in terms of the funding, but I think any jurisdiction that would make this kind of an investment, the return to this state, is huge. And I don't think any of us can tell how significant it would end up being.
Thank you. Mr. Ranieri.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gene Ranieri. I'm the Intergovernmental Relations Director for the City of Minneapolis. In 2001, the city did receive for NRP $20 million. Since then, it has gone down. In 2002, it was around $11 million, dropped down to about $10 million. Now it's under $5 million, basically because of things stated, and also, I think, changes in tax increment law, too. Pre-79 districts, I think, in the mid-90s, can only be used to pay off debt. And then also the 79 districts limited how much you could use for, again, paying off non-debt. So between a combination of all the things said plus TIF, we've seen the commitment from $20 million a year pre-2001 to less than $5 million now. We can provide you with more additional information and projections for 2009, which are even lower.
Mr. Ranieri, can you help the committee understand what is the city of Minneapolis process from the city level to think through this issue? Are we going to hear from the mayor before the omnibus tax bill is put together? Is the city council weighing in? I think we need more information.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the city council and the IGR committee is going to discuss this issue. The Ways and Means Committee is looking at the financial impacts because this has an impact also on the general financial not only of the city but also of the county, the school district, and the park board because it is tax increment financing. We will probably have a position talking tomorrow in front of our IGR committee, bringing to the city council on Friday. The folks in the Ways and Means will be looking at this whole issue over the next year and what is the best way to go in terms of decertification of tax increment districts in 2009, but we have some coming online in 2012 and 2016. So there should be some positions from the city and some recommendations on what to do within the next week or two.
Representative Earhart, can you wait, Representative Earhart?
Sure.
Mr. Miller?
Madam Chair, I don't mean to try to butt in on this, but I do want to clarify that it's not $5 million, under $5 million for the last 2 years for NRP's resources from the city. It's $1.8 million from 2005, and it's $1.2 million from 2006, both of which are not revenues from the tax increment districts. They're the interest off of the reserve that we have built up to fund the neighborhood programs.
Thank you for that clarification. Representative Earhart.
Maybe I don't remember how TIF works, Madam Chair, but it seems to me it takes money off of the general tax rolls to be used for whatever purposes, in this case, neighborhood revitalization. And I haven't heard anybody say, I'm not arguing that you've got done something with this program and you got a whole bunch of people that are jumping up and down and saying, let's keep going. No arguing with that. I'm just trying to figure out what the numbers are here. Minneapolis has been in trouble having enough money to do the proper job with their police, if not their fire, as I understand it, from what I've been reading in the paper. And they're complaining about not getting enough LGA to have the proper police departments and have the many people they like. Now, I think that the money that might otherwise go to support that police department is going into neighborhood revitalization. Maybe I'm wrong, but am I hearing this right? Or has somebody got any real numbers here? I mean, it's a great plan. Everybody's excited about it. But the finances of it, are a little unclear.
Representative Earhart, we're going to have Representative Daphne speak that in, Mr. Ranieri. And we do want to get to the other bills, too. But members, this is a very important provision, and my guess is honestly that we won't get it completely worked out this year. But we need to think about whether or not we're going to have Representative Clark's bill passed that would have a study so we could get some more information. But Representative Earhart, the one way I've thought about it is actually, in a way it's sort of counter what you're saying, if they couldn't continue to do this program, they would actually get less LGA. Why? Because tax base would come on the tax roll, so right. Their need would appear to be smaller. So you could see that they wouldn't want that to happen. That makes sense to me, why they wouldn't want it to happen. But I think us not having the numbers is problematic. Trying to understand, is there a way to hold Minneapolis harmless? Because from the state legislature's perspective, and for those of us who are spend a lot of time thinking about TIF, and Representative Lanning is over there thinking and not speaking, so I don't know what he's thinking. But, you know, we don't want these tax increment finance districts to not be certified. They're supposed to be certified. They need to come on the tax rolls, and particularly these pre-1979s are kind of old rules, not allowed anymore. So if we were moved forward into time, we wouldn't even let these kind of TIF districts happen. So I think the need is obvious. The desire to fund is obvious. It doesn't have to be this way, probably, is the question for the tax committee. And I think that's what you're struggling with, Representative Earhart. It wouldn't be my intent to try to do something to end up giving Minneapolis a penalty now for sort of doing the right thing and letting things decertify. So I think this is a complication that we need to get more information from the city on. Representative Dabney, to this point, maybe you can help us think this through.
We'll see. thank you, Doctor. I'm actually going to leave the numbers piece to people smarter than I am. But I want to respond to Representative Earhart's contention that you've got money tied up over here, which should be being used for cops over here. And I understand the argument, sir. However, if you listen to the testimony, and if you think a little more broadly about not cops, but crime, a lot of the work that the NRP groups have done in terms of
economic development, in terms of strengthening the housing stock, in terms of stabilizing neighborhoods, in terms of getting people out of their houses and into community festivals and neighborhood groups and block watches and block walking groups. That's crime fighting. It's not a cop in a squad car. It's crime prevention, because you're knitting together the communities, you're providing opportunities, you're funding kids' programs to get kids off the street and organizers to help engage them. It's not the stuff that shows up on TV and CSI, but it is the stuff that stops crime. And maybe former and now current Representative Keith Ellison said it best. Economic opportunity stops crime. Crime stops economic opportunity. And so when we do things that rebuild Franklin Avenue, we stop crime. So I'd encourage you to think, you know, think about it in a larger and different framework. Thank you for that time, Madam Chair.
Mr. Ranieri, did you want to try to throw in on Representative Earhart's issue there on the LGA and the pieces moving around? Then we'll go to Representative Lanning.
Madam Chair, I think it was both said by Representative Davin.
Okay. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have been thinking. you know, this we heard this bill in local government, and I don't have any doubt or any question whatsoever as to the value of this program for neighborhood revitalization, for making the neighborhood safer, etc. What I'm interested in, as we try to sort through this, Mr. Ranieri, if you don't have it now, if you could get us some information. Do we have any evidence that the crime just hasn't moved to another neighborhood? Another issue, do we have any indication of what this program has done for affordable housing? So when you talk about housing in a neighborhood going from 40,000, 50,000 up to 250,000, to me that doesn't solve any affordable housing problems, maybe create some problems. And I don't expect you to have all this information right now, Mr. Ranieri, but I would be interested in what the city of Minneapolis can offer us in terms of is there evidence that crime isn't just shifted to another neighborhood nearby? Is there some evidence that affordable housing, in fact, has improved or increased? Couple of questions.
Madam Chair, we can get that information to Representative Lanning and to the committee.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, a couple of numbers. The city's tax capacity is about $435 million. In tax increment financing is around $64 million. We have about 15% of our gross tax capacity in tax increment financing, so it's a little higher than state average. At one time, we were fairly high. In 2009, half of it's supposed to go away, or about $34 million. And the rest will remain till 2012, 2016, and beyond. In addition, that raises around $65 million in 2005, as reported by the state auditor, much lower than before 2001. And we can get you flow charts and graphs of all the numbers.
I think that'd be helpful, really. I think this, the more information, the better on this one, because it's a small group of people who really have to sit down and really think it through with the Minneapolis delegation. Mr. Miller.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. With regards to your question, Representative Earhart, I would point out that neighborhoods have invested in policing. They have bought buyback patrols. They have hired off-duty police officers. They have put over $1 million in a single year to help support some policing shortages that the city was experiencing. In addition to that, they've helped take down boarded and vacant buildings when there wasn't any city dollars for it. Neighborhoods have responded to those types of needs. I think that's one of the things that kind of gets lost in this. This isn't about the city against the neighborhoods. It's the city basically being supported by the neighborhoods and the neighborhoods being supported by the city. It works both ways. And I think that's one of the things that we otherwise kind of forget. I do think that's I think that's one of the things that, as you look at this particular type of program, it is different. And it's a lot different than what you normally see. And it's not just about dollars that are going into projects. Representative Lanning, you were talking about affordable housing.
for a three-year period of time, when this was a really emerging issue for the city and for our neighborhoods, we set aside a special reserve fund just for affordable housing, and we leveraged dollars because of it. We put anywhere from $3 to $9 million a year into that type of activity, and we've leveraged literally hundreds of millions of dollars in affordable housing projects. That was at program level, but each neighborhood did their own work in that area. So there has been efforts to basically meet the needs as according to how the neighborhoods see it. There's been investments in libraries to help them to stay open and to improve. There was investments in schools to get computers when no one else could do it. There was investments in playgrounds when there were problems with the fact that people couldn't play on the grounds anymore because they were in such bad shape. You know, and you can talk about this as being only one little piece of it, but Representative Davin is absolutely right. This is a big tapestry. If all these little pieces start falling apart, somebody else is going to pick up the tab. And it's going to be the rest of the state, and it's going to be the rest of the city, and we're going to end up getting adversely impacted by it. Neighbors kind of are plugging the dike, and they're trying to do things that are creative, and they use their volunteer resources, the energy and the commitment of the people you saw here today, who are just one little tip of the iceberg. We have hundreds and thousands of people out there working on behalf of the community all the time. We've got 70 boards out there. We average over 15 people per board. That's 1,000 residents who don't get paid a dime to come to meetings at least once a month to talk about things like, what should we do to make our community safer, make our housing better, make our schools more secure? That's the kind of stuff that they do, and they do it without charging us anything.
Thank you. Did you have more, Representative Earhart?
No, I have to leave, so I do want to say something. I don't object to what's going on here, but I think that, and to take, I'm picking on the police force because that's been in the paper. That there isn't enough money for that, and the crime has moved to the north side now, and so forth and so on. But I think the point is that you got a heck of a mess in there with the schools and crime, and if this is one of the things that can help, is this the best thing that can be done? I don't know that, but I think it's something that should be talked about. There are other cities around, like Bloomington, who should be getting the flow from a TIF district out there that... they want to crank around and use for something else again now. And so now I'm asking the same thing here. Is there a better way of doing it? I'm not objecting to it. I'm just trying to figure out what's happening. But I got to go. Thank you.
Madam Chair,
thank you for that. And I think we should give each of the three Minneapolis legislators the closing comments, and we need to go on. But I hope it's helping the committee think about this. I want the NRP folks who are here to know that I don't think anybody here is questioning that this isn't valuable. And the question where it becomes a concern for the legislature is, the city of Minneapolis could just fund this program to the tune of $5 million a year, $10 million a year, whatever it is, all on its own without any state help. And so the rest of legislators need to understand why TIF should be used to do it. It's the source of funding because that is a state cost. But I think Mr. Ranieri has given us a good piece of information. We subsidize TIF districts. People hate to hear that word. But the truth is, we subsidize TIF districts across the state. People think TIF districts are free. Nope, they have a state subsidy. They are corporate subsidies. And we have 2,000 of them. But I think the most important information I learned from this hearing so far is that Minneapolis is about at the state average of 15% of its tax capacity in TIF. So I think that's helpful to understand. Maybe you're not looking for a greater subsidy than anyone else. But it is important for people to know that this isn't free money. It absolutely has a state cost that has to be found on a spreadsheet. And I think that it isn't the good thing here. It's just, where is the money going to come from? Representative Davin, then Mulry, and Representative Clark, closing comments.
I think I've said anything of value that I could say, and maybe more.
Thank you. Representative Mulry.
Well, Madam Chair, just once again, I think the difference is, in this case, the state made a commitment and then changed things on it and took the money away, which is a huge difference from all the other circumstances. And the one other thing that hasn't been said, there's a question about whether the need is, and versus police, an awful lot of cops, many dozens, have told me that this is an extremely important part of helping them stop the crime in Minneapolis.
Thank you. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You've given such a good chance for us to bring this before you, and I really appreciate it. I just want to say one thing. I have asked for some numbers to help you out, and I want to say that in addition to this being a state cost, it's definitely a state savings and a state generator of funding. And I just want to keep that in the balance sheet because I passed out a couple sheets. One of them was the median single family sales place median, and I think another one was the assessment. And I don't have the assessments here before me, but I can just tell you that if you look at the one that has this single family sales place median, how many houses on there? I'm not my individual house, but
Mark, did you know that your house is available to the public on the Hennepin County website? All of you who live in Hennepin County, I think Ramsey's got this now too, you can go on the Hennepin County website and look up any resident in all of Hennepin County and what their home value is and what their taxes are. So Representative Clarkwell, we may not have it in front of us. We can look it up later.
Good, and I think if we could do a historical review of my particular house, you'll see that when I bought it, for the first back in 1984, it was the value that it had then. Shortly after I bought it, it went down, and that's what this graph shows too. That the houses that were bought here in 1994, bought mine in 84, mine went down, and it went down, 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 just like these did. So I actually, at one point, I remember sitting over here thinking, if I were to try to sell my house today, I'd lose $20,000 of equity on it. That's how depressed the value was. And as Ms. Pence showed, it was with the NRP bringing back the neighborhood, making the whole concept of our neighborhood safer so that people wanted to invest and that they wanted to live in communities like ours, we brought our values back up again. And so the day, I mean, I just didn't get my assessment, I had no idea that it was quite that high because it's not, I don't plan to sell it and it's not something I'm going to cash in on. But my taxes to the state have more than tripled from when I bought my house. And others may have similar stories throughout the state, but I can say in an inner city neighborhood where the value went down, came back up, and now where it's at, certainly contributing back to the state, and I think many of the people who are here today would say that we feel like the investment is good because we are giving back to the state value that wasn't there too. So I've asked the county and the city to give us the change and help us give to you the numbers of what the percentage is, what goes out, but then what comes back, and I'll try to get that to you. They are starting to do that in those two charts you had today at the beginning.
Thank you for that, Representative Clark. Thank you all and all of you who come today. Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, I was just while they're leaving, you had to point out, being that Representative Clark talked about where her house is. I grew up in the heart of the state.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
It's now called, I can see the sign here, Chiropractic Center. It used to be a family right. Physician office until 1958. That's where I used to go to the doctor.
Oh. Thank you.
Somewhere
thank you.
About where she grew up.
That's right. Thank you, Representative
Simpson. Just to that point, I think it's a good thing that Representative Welty didn't have his bill up after this bill because it kind of proves his point on a small city, the need of TIF.
Good point. Thank you for that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Clark, and thank you, Testifiers. We are going to go to, if Representative Mullery can wait, because we have, if that's all right, because you're on the committee. Is that okay, Representative Mullery?
I'm not sure how, both bills have a couple of witnesses that have to leave it.
Okay. Representative Nornick has people who can't leave by 5:30. Representative Lane is actually after Representative Mullery, then Kalin, then Hillstrom. If there's anybody who has people who have to leave by a certain time, please send a note up to Sarah here so we know. Representative Mullery, then your bill is next. Did you want to wait or you have testifiers?
I couldn't. I mean, I'm going to be here, but the testifiers have to leave as
well. Okay. We're going to take them in order. Representative Mullery is next then. And I failed to lay over Representative Clark's bill, House File 822, and I'll do that now for possible inclusion. And Representative Mullery moves his own bill, House File 1686. And I see now by note that we're going to have Representative Kalin right after that because one of his testifiers has to leave. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I would move 1686. Does this go anywhere, or is it just laid over?
Thank you. For possible inclusion.
Okay. Representative Mallory, does it need to go somewhere? I don't think so.
No, I don't believe so.
I'm pretty sure not. Just never know, like the last one. Madam Chair and members, and this is another one. In 1995, several cities in the state received a special kind of tax increment district called a housing replacement district. And it was for scattered sites which were either vacant or contained vacant houses or structurally substandard houses. And then a few years later, they then expanded it and allowed Minneapolis and I believe St. Paul and Duluth, I think, to have 200 of such houses. And now Minneapolis is in the situation where we need to have an expansion to at least 300. And what it does is it really helps eliminate blight and substandard properties in the neighborhoods. The problem is that when you look at the cost of acquiring the site and then rehabbing it or else putting in a different home, if it's so bad that they can't structurally repair it, that cost is more than they can resell it. And so you can use this TIF to make up that difference. And we have two witnesses here that would explain the need for this and how important it's been to the inner city neighborhoods of both North and South Minneapolis.
Thank you. Welcome.
My name is Glennis Trewisha. I work with Neighborhood Housing Services of Minneapolis. Neighborhood Housing Services was established back in October of 1980, and over the last 26, 27 years has invested and reinvested tens of millions of dollars. Today, I took a drive through one particular neighborhood of ours, Jordan neighborhood, which you've already heard represented here today, with an interest of comparing it to what Jordan saw and looked like back in 1992 and 93 when they were preparing for their NRP Phase 1. And I found different interesting maps. I found a map that had a bunch of little black dots on it on boarded and abandoned properties. My colleague and I drove the streets of Jordan this morning and found no less than 165 boarded or vacant properties, and it looks like it did 20 years ago. For all the investment and reinvestment that's been happening in the city, the number of properties that have been abandoned as a result of predatory lending and just wholesale abandonment, it's just devastating to watch. Over 79% of the foreclosures and abandoned properties in North Minneapolis are a result of refinancing, not acquiring a house beyond your means. This is a neighborhood of Minneapolis that is cash poor, equity rich. They had the American dream, and it bit them. And I don't know where these 165 families are now. I just know that they're not in North Minneapolis. As we attack the vacant property issue by taking it one property at a time and always at the direction and interest of the neighborhood, we bring the properties back and make sure that they are in a condition that there will be no major repairs for minimally the first 5 years of ownership. We want to do it again. We had fabulous success with NRP Phase 1. We know that with the anti-predatory legislation going through the city that the likelihood of this happening again is greatly reduced. The amount that the subsidies come in to help with the assistance of bringing these properties back to mortgageable condition is priceless, and we do appreciate your consideration. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
I guess it's almost evening now. My name is Sherry Pugh Sullivan, and I'm the executive director of the Northside Residents Redevelopment Council. We're a 36-year-old neighborhood-based council established after the rebellions in 1968 in the Near North, Willard Hay, and formerly public housing communities. So we've been at this for a long time. To tell you a story about our neighborhood, which is two neighborhoods consisting of about 1,300 housing structures, that after the rebellions in 68, there was vast disinvestment, lots of vacant homes and properties. Merrick, along with two other nonprofits, Project for Pride and Living and Gimmick, diligently worked over a 10-year span of time to basically build and rehab over 200 units in our community. So when we reached 2000, we thought we had made it. We had taken two neighborhoods that had an homeownership rate of less than 25% to one of those neighborhoods now being at 35% and the other one at 60%. But things changed, because what caught up with us, as my colleague has just mentioned, was the egregious attack of predatory lenders in our neighborhood. Sometimes it feels like they just parachute them in. And they've taken over, and people have lost homes. And with the loss of homes, we now have seen new abandonment of properties. Our organization does some mortgage foreclosure counseling for the whole North Side. And in 2005, we had over 400 people contact us, and there were 800 foreclosures in the city total. In 2006, that figure reached over 1,200, and we had 500 calls. We assisted over 200 families and provided loans to 90, but there were a lot of families we could not help. We could not save their homes for them. And people aren't losing their homes, as has been stated, because of just total mismanagement of finance. They've had family experiences, loss of job, a health incident, but more egregious is lending products that have put them in jeopardy, have them in products where their houses are overpriced for their actual value, or payments that escalate that they can no longer keep up with. So this bill really provides us another tool, along with NRP, along with the resources that we have as nonprofits, to really try and recapture our community. We are really at a tipping point. And so the ability to have tools that can help us capture the abandoned properties, get them back in shape, and get them into home ownership is critical. Also, one of the things that we face in our community is our housing stock is old. We are a city neighborhood. Most of our housing has been built before 1935. And so some of it really has aged and can't be of service, and others can be renovated. So we hope that you will support this bill because it is an important tool for our community. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions for Representative Mullery or his testifiers? Or is there anyone in the public who would like to testify either for or against? Well, Representative Mullery, this wasn't nearly as controversial as the last one. I don't know.
Well, Madam Chair,
maybe people are tired.
Madam Chair, if you notice, the last one was not my bill. My last bill was pretty non-controversial. It was helping the police get their pension exclusions.
That's right. Well, if there are no questions, I want to thank Representative Mullery and his testifiers, and I will lay over House File 1686 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. And we are now going to go to Representative Kalin, House File 2176, who has someone who needs to be somewhere. So if that's all right with Representative Lane, and we're again jumping over Representative Mullery here. Representative Kalin, welcome to the committee. Is there someone who will move Representative Kalin's bill? Representative Tilbury moves House File 2171. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 2176, just a brief correction, correct?
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. House File 2176. I apologize.
Just want to make sure I'm not presenting a bill that I
don't know
anything about. we could try that song and dance. But the bill before you is a bill that I've been working with State Auditor Rebecca Otto on, and appreciate her coming here today and speaking about the need for a little bit of oversight with our Job Z program in Minnesota. In my district, we have the honor of the first two projects, Polaris in Wyoming, and then Anderson Windows in North Branch. And they've both proven to be very good corporate citizens and members of our community, but many local elected officials expressed to me a desire for a little bit more oversight of the program, and I agree with them, so that we can build confidence in the projects that are working and doing what was intended, but also help improve the projects that maybe aren't delivering as many jobs as we hope they would or that they promised. I'll leave it to Auditor Otto to talk about the finer points of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Kalin, and welcome to the committee. I was going to say Representative Otto. Auditor Otto.
Oh, great. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Nobody knows what to call me. But that was pretty good. Okay, so this bill actually, just to give you a little bit of background, in 2005, I'm Rebecca Otto, by the way. Back in 2005, the TIF division of the Office of the State Auditor was required to annually audit the creation and operation of all job opportunity building zones and business subsidy agreements entered into pursuant to the Jobs Act. So we have the oversight function. This bill is to authorize the state auditor to request, number one, tax return information from the Commissioner of Revenue from taxpayers who are qualified businesses, and wage detail report information from the Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development of taxpayers eligible as qualified businesses. Lastly, it also mandates that qualified businesses submit to Revenue the report listing the tax benefits received in the previous year or lose their status as a qualified business. We have met with Revenue several times. We've met with Deed several times. I even met with the Commissioner of Deed to make sure we were all on the same page. Just so you understand, Department of Revenue is the enforcement arm of this whole thing. Deed is the promoter of JobZ, and our office is the oversight function. And so this bill allows us to get our hands on the data that we need, because some of it is sensitive data, and we're used to dealing with that in our office. So, and Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Auditor Otto. Are there questions for Representative Kalin or Auditor Otto? Is there testimony from the public, either for or against, or the Department of Revenue on this? If not, Representative Kalin, I think this is a really good bill. I think we have all been sort of hoping to get more information. And I also understand, if I may, Auditor Otto, you have, my understanding is you expressed a concern in your office that you're unable to collect the fees to do the audits, and I know that's not contemplated here. Is that in the shakeup finance bill?
Madam Chair, members, we are asking for a general fund appropriation. We don't have a fee mechanism for this particular program, so it would be a general fund appropriation, and unless somebody can dream up a way to create fees, I believe there was a problem with trying to do a retroactive fee. That's difficult to do, so that would be, you know, we couldn't think of anything, frankly, so we've asked for the appropriation, and it's in the state government finance bill.
Thank you. I just thought I'd ask, because I know that those of us on the tax committee want to get the information on this, on these, on TIF and JobZ, but it wouldn't be fair really to ask you to go get it and then not provide the money to do that. So I just wanted to check on that. But I do know that, Representative Kalin, I just wanted you to know that I am aware that people are really big fans of JobZ, want your bill to pass, and people who really hate JobZ want your bill to pass. So, I think that's very interesting that people are convinced the data's on their side, and I think that just says that we need to get the data. So I appreciate you bringing this forward, and unless there are other questions or testifiers, Representative Wolfsmeyer.
You know, to that point, Representative Kalin and Auditor Otto, I was on a school board for 8 years, and one thing we absolutely detested as a local school board was the state, you know, Board of Education having all of these lists, because it seemed like, you know, no matter what happened, you know, I just use the five-star system. You know, our little school would get 3 stars, and we would get really passionate about that, because by our data, we were 4 stars, or we were 5 stars. So, I mean, I really caution you with, you know, please look on all sides of this, of how you're reporting the data, and make it clear so that, oh, you're going to end up with those types of issues on this JobZ, of where somebody passionately feels they're 4 stars and your data says they're 3 stars, and just please work through that, because we have a long history of arguing about data.
Madam Chair?
Auditor Otto.
I want to say
that.
Auditor.
Or you can say
Auditor Otto.
Or state auditor, and then it's easy. Okay. Representative, oh my goodness. Thank you, Wolfslager. It's been a long day. That's a good point. We won't be rating them with stars. What we are is we're an oversight office that is very used to dealing with numbers and finances, and we'll be getting all the numbers laid out to look at it and looking at, we'll be able to give you better information on the program, but there's no political ideology in here. It's all going to be very straight and factual. And then you all get to make the decision in terms of how you feel about the program, because ultimately it's in your hands. So.
Thank you, Representative
Kalin. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Wolfslager. That's a concern of mine as well, and I will print out and provide for you the original, I think, first in the nation business subsidy disclosure report card that Minnesota adopted, I think it was the late 80s or early 90s. There's an example that I can also, I'll email you the URL, the link, that some of this data is available for TIF. It's just not as available for Job Z currently, but in terms of easy access to public information. But the one that really sticks out for me is a subsidy that was somewhere in the neighborhood of $246,000, if I can remember right, for a TIF district. And the jobs created were one Dairy Queen job at somewhere like $7.46 an hour. It's obviously the most extreme example of this. And so there are, we have a history of doing this in pretty accurate, hard number ways that don't politicize it and are just the numbers, just the facts, ma'am. And I think that's what we're after.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to speak for or against this bill? If not, I will lay over House Files
2176,
which I believe we had the wrong summary in our text. So we've got it figured out.
Great. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Auditor Otto. And Representative Mullery, do you have this? Does the person who's here need to go, or can we move? Representative Pepin has people have to leave, and Representative Nornes. Representative Mullery, how would you like to speak? See, Representative Mullery, when you have all these bills, I have to keep asking you.
How soon do you have to leave?
Is there anyone here?
What? Looking at the witness.
I'm here for the duration.
Oh,
okay.
Okay.
We'd love to hear that.
We can stop too.
Okay, if we could get Representative Pepin then, who's way up there. Thank you, Representative Pepin. And Representative Pepin, could someone move Representative Pepin's bill? It's House File 1789. Representative Lanning moves House File 1789, and Representative Lanning also moves the H1789A1 amendment for Representative Pepin to get it into the form she would like it. Looking for a nod that she really does want this amendment.
I need to get a copy
of it. Representative Pepin, did you want this A1 amendment?
I do want the amendment, Madam Chair. I would like someone else here to explain the amendment.
Well, we'll just get it in the form you like it. Is there discussion, members? All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Pepin,
thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, House File 1789 would simply allow the city of Dayton to create a tax increment financing district that would allow for the completion of an interchange on I-94 at Brockton Avenue between the cities of Maple Grove and Rogers. And we bring this forward, members, because currently there's a deadly six-mile stretch between the 95th Avenue exit in Maple Grove and 101 in Rogers. This is the longest stretch of highway in the Twin Cities with no exit, and is one of the top five fastest-growing corridors in the United States. This exit is absolutely crucial for residents and travelers in the northwest suburbs, yet it is not on MnDOT's short-range plan. We believe this bill offers a good solution for the problem. This is a TIF bill, as we mentioned, and how it would work is that the developer, the Beer Group, would front the cost of the interchange along with federal funds of up to $6 million. This legislation would set the TIF district up as an economic development TIF, and therefore it would be an 8-year district. And I did want to point out, Madam Chair and members, that the affected area, Dayton and Hanson, is currently under 2.5% in TIF, so they are not maxed out in TIF by any means. We're very excited about this proposal, and it has wide community support. And I'm going to turn it over to some of my testifiers. Mr. Bill Sherbert, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, pardon?
Was it Mr. Sherber? Was that correct?
Joe Sherber from Hanson Township, and I have a little prepared statement here. I've been a lifelong resident of Hanson Township as well as chair of the Hanson Town Board of Supervisors, and I'm appearing here today to express my strong support of the proposed development of the interchange of Brockton and I-94. The interchange, the financing by the Beard Group and the state we have, and we have 21 cities that are behind us, and they want this in the worst ways along with us. And I have farmed in Lower Hanson Township my entire life, and you know, as a child, I played along most of these roads in Hanson Township and rode my bike on them and drove my tractors on them and my combines and everything else. And as a little kid, it was only like 10, 15 cars a day. You know, like I tell everybody, one of them was always the mailman. So, and now today, there's 300 to 400 cars. That's how our community has grown in my lifetime. this interchange is needed for two main reasons: safety and quality of life. Right now there are 6 miles like Joyce has said, on I-94 from County Road 30 to Highway 101 in Rogers, where there are absolutely no exits, and in case of an accident, really there's no way to get to them hardly, because at certain times of the evening it's really jammed up bad, you know, bumper to bumper and 20, 30 miles an hour, and sometimes 10 miles an hour. And as it is right now, the flow of traffic and is so heavy that it means longer drives for all the people that live in our community and the surrounding communities. If we can reduce that amount of time, that will improve the quality of life for the people in our community. They'll be home quicker, be able to spend more time with their families, which I have a number of children that live in our community, so I'm enthused about that too. I-94 was developed some time ago when I was just a teenager. The people who said having the interstate come through Hanson Township would wreck our community, that has not happened. It has enhanced our community tremendously, made it a great place to live. As we can tell by the amount of people that want to move in there, they like it, and we enjoy seeing them there. I believe developing the Brockton interchange at I-94 will have the same positive impact in our community. Yeah. I think we are very lucky to have this incredible opportunity to build this interchange, and it won't cost the township or the nearby cities money to do it. The land around Brockton Lane, will be developed regardless of what happens at this interchange. But if we can also build an interchange that we know we need, and we will be able to increase the tax base of our surrounding lands for all of our cities involved. And there is like five cities that are directly involved with this interchange. That would be Maple Grove, Dayton, Hanson, Rogers, and Corcoran. By using the TIF district process, working with private developers, we are able to build this interchange now, capture the increased tax value from the new development, and ultimately have a safe corridor for driving. And we have increased revenue for our township and surrounding cities. If we don't capitalize on this opportunity, we won't get this interchange completed for many years to come. While MnDOT sees this as a necessary project, which they told me personally that it was a necessary project, it is not on their projected schedule for at least another 25 plus years, which is really way out there for all the rest of our people in our community. I have lived and played and worked in Haslam Township, the last township in Hennepin County, by the way. As a member of this community, I am concerned about how we improve the roads, the safety, quality of life for those who live here and for those who travel through our community. I strongly support the creation of the TIF district to ultimately develop the Brockton Lane I-94 interchange, as I know it will make our Rogers region and Haslam region and the Dayton region a better place to live and travel through. Thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome.
I'm Doug Anderson, Mayor of Dayton. Madam Chair, thank you for members. Thank you for having us and moving us up on the schedule. I have a son who's got a 14th birthday party tonight, so I do need to get to that.
Better get out of here.
We do appreciate you again hearing us. We believe this interchange is a very vital part of the interstate system and our economic development in northern Hennepin County. It is, as Jill said, the township is the last township in Hennepin County. Dayton has also remained largely undeveloped because we are two landlocked communities. I've been on the council, city council, for 15 years, and it's been a goal and an aspiration of mine just to see this happen. Through the help of the local business community and the development that is coming into Haslam, we've found a way that we think we can fund this interchange. We've certainly tried to get MnDOT's here for a long time and have been told that it's, well, we're moving, it's 2020, then it's 2030, and you know, who knows when. So obviously, the state is strapped for funds to do these things, as are the county and the city. So we believe that this is a very innovative partnership, and it's an excellent way for us to get this done. I was in Washington a week and a half ago and met with our congressional delegates, and we believe that we have a pretty good shot at some matching federal funds to help this project out. So I think we're at a window of opportunity right now that if we don't get it done now, things probably will be put off till 10, 20 years in the future. And with that, we'll... Kathleen?
Thank you, Mary Anderson.
Thank
Welcome.
Welcome. Good afternoon. I'm Kathleen Pote, and I am president of the I-94 West Chamber. The I-94 West Chamber represents over 600 businesses in seven communities along the I-94 corridor, including Dayton and Haslam. The Chamber supports the economic impact that the interchange at I-94 and Brockton Lane will have on this region and on the state. The interchange will provide an opportunity to increase the local tax base and create new jobs in the area. This will allow the area to continue to be among the fastest growing in the nation. The proposed interchange will provide a needed safety benefit for the residents of the area and those passing through. During congested travel times, this stretch of roadway from Brockton to Highway 101, totaling more than 5 miles, creates a vehicle stacking situation that basically immobilizes this portion of the interstate. There have been 29 fatalities in the last 7 years on this section of interstate alone. The creation of an interchange between Maple Grove and Rogers would help alleviate this problem. The I-94 Brockton Lane Interchange is a critical transportation project for the Northwest Metro. Located less than 20 miles from Minneapolis, the interchange project is vital, has a vital significance to the communities of Dayton and Haslam and their future economic growth. I have a little trouble as I end, but thank you very much. We do thank you for any support that you will give this project.
Thank you, Mrs. Holt. Was it Holt?
Holt.
Thank you. Are there questions for Representative Pepin or for her testimony? Mr. Tinklenberg is here as well. I didn't see a switch spot. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's good to be with you. I appreciate your consideration. I've been involved in transportation for a long time, and much of that time have been looking at the way in which transportation provides for a manageable, sustainable economic development of our state. I think this is an example of that kind of an opportunity. This is a project that will open up an infill area, and I know it's got to be a little strange for some of you to hear that this is an infill area, and it is. All you have to do is drive to Otsego and St. Michael and Monticello and see what's happening farther and farther out. This is a way of capturing some of that kind of growth, but it wouldn't be possible without the interchange, and the interchange is made possible by the kind of development that is proposed there, as you see in the area in Hassan. The Stone's Throw development is really creating the kind of density and the kind of tax base that makes it possible to develop the interchange. At the same time, the interchange makes it possible to for this development to proceed. The development, as you can see, is on about 630 acres of land. The densities that are possible in the development allow for the preservation of over 200 acres of open space, almost 14 miles of trails, 10 acres of parks, and an additional area to the south end of the project that is a wonderful, beautiful forest that would normally be very, very prime developed land, and is going to be able to be preserved and protected as a part of this because of the commercial area and the density of the commercial area that's being proposed. Madam Chair, I know that you are aware, and members, you're aware of projects of this size, and the full build-out value of this development is estimated to be someplace approaching $1.5 billion. You've seen projects of this size come before the legislature and ask for hundreds of millions of dollars in state subsidy to make them go. In this case, this development needs a $20 million intersection, and all of the proposed TIF is being proposed to build the public improvement at the intersection. None of it goes to the developer. As a matter of fact, the developer is contributing to the project by putting upfront dollars into the process to help with the preliminary design, environmental review, and has pledged their funding of the intersection. If this legislation passes, they will upfront the total cost of the intersection and assume all of the risk of being paid back. The risk does not fall on the communities, not fall on the taxpayers. So this is a very important, we think, public-private partnership that allows for this kind of development to occur, that is very much in concert with the Metropolitan Council's a plan for regional development. Again, I know that you are aware of areas that have resisted this kind of growth. This is an area that embraces this kind of opportunity and wants to see it go forward, and it is only being delayed because of the lack of this intersection, this interchange in this area. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to join with the other testifiers in answering any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, question. I think the testimony was, and that's Mr. Kinslinger, being the former highway commissioner. 5 miles between Highway 30 and 101, I think, is the total.
It's almost 6 miles, Madam Chair.
6 miles.
Yes.
But the question I was going to ask with your former hat on then, are there other demands along that stretch, being that it's so long, for additional exchanges beyond this one? That is such a fast growth area, and I do make that drive periodically. There's some that lives in Decker, so I can go up to Monticello and then over.
Madam Chair, Representative, the area between where the new 610 connection will be and 101, there are not other connection will be and 101, there are not other opportunities because of spacing requirements in the federal interstate standards. There really isn't another opportunity anywhere in between that for another interchange. This has been identified as the place There is a regional sub-area study that is underway right now that has identified this as the site. It's been identified in the comprehensive plans of the communities. We have resolutions of support for this site from, I think it's 19 other local units of government for this site to be the interchange.
And Madam Chair, I don't have any problem with this site. I was just wondering if there were additional.
No, I don't believe so.
Thank you. Representative Wolfmeyer.
Yeah, Chair and members, Representative Pepin, as you know, I'm a freshman, and I stood on the House floor on Saturday and testified much like some of your testifiers, that I live in Cannon Falls, we have Highway 52 with two stoplights, we have had multiple fatalities, etc., etc. It's a very unsafe interchange. We, too, are looking for money from the Minnesota Department of Transportation to fix that. But again, as I said, I'm a freshman, and I thought that, you know, getting a road exchange or interchange fixed was through the Department of Transportation, not through the Department of Taxes. So I'm having a hard time with this one. Why, you know, why would you do this versus, you know, be in favor of a transportation bill?
No, Madam Chair, Representative Wolfsberger, well, primarily because if we do go through the channel, we've already been told by MnDOT that this wouldn't be on the radar for another 25 to 30 years. And there are certainly many pressing needs, and we think that this is an innovative way to be able to get the project done using the developers' upfront payments and then to use the increment to pay them back. I don't think that area, because of its the danger, can wait another 25 or 30 years. That, you could say that perhaps about a lot of projects, but like I mentioned in my earlier testimony, this is probably the top third or fourth fastest growing corridor in the entire United States, from what we've been told from Congressman Ramstead and Congressman Oberstar, both of whom support this legislation and both of whom are trying to get federal funds for this. So we really believe that now is the time to do it. We believe that because of Congressman Oberstar's position in Congress, this is a good time to do it. And I would love to be able to say MnDOT could fund this project, but I don't think that waiting 25 or 30 years on a six-mile stretch of dangerous highway, the busiest highway corridor in this, probably in the state or close to it, I just don't think it we can wait to do it, and I think this is a very innovative compromise.
Madam Chair, if I could add, Representative Olsfager, I don't think there was anyone at MnDOT who has ever spent more money on Highway 52 than I did. That is an important corridor and a critical improvement, and you're right. Those are areas that need to be a part of the plan, and I think any efforts to move that forward are important efforts. In this particular instance, in this corridor, this is an opportunity that's made possible by virtue of the development itself. And without it, development will, as the town board chair has said, will continue to occur. It will just be less dense residential development that will occur in that corridor, and it will eliminate the opportunity of using this kind of a mechanism, and will lose the opportunity to develop the kind of densities that really support the regional growth management strategies that have been adopted by the Metropolitan Council. It will make it much, much harder for that kind of development to occur in this particular part of the region, really reduce the densities. And as a part of this, and you can see on the handout, the northern portion of the development is right along the rail line that comes northwest out of Minneapolis, and provides, again, the kind of densities that make it possible to explore a future option of that rail line as a commuter corridor or a light rail corridor, expanding the list of options that are available in the region to provide transportation. But it requires those kind of densities to make that feasible.
Thank you,
Mr. Tinkleberg. Believe me, I'm happy to hear that you were a part of trying to fund Highway 52. And, you know, without trying to get too political here, the difference is, you know what, I stood on the House floor and said I was in support of a transportation bill that was going to raise taxes. Hardly a popular
stand, and your representative did not. That's the difference.
Representative Lawrence.
Well, Madam Chair, to say that the developer is making this great thing because he's kicking in something doesn't seem like much in view of the fact that the value of the land's probably worth a lot less without the interchange, and he probably had got it pretty cheap. And I really wonder if we need more commercial in that strip. It seems like there's an awful lot of commercial going in. But I also had one question. One of the witnesses said that this community was landlocked, and I always thought that meant it didn't have a major river or an ocean or something. And isn't most of Minnesota then landlocked, or what in the world is that supposed to mean?
Madam Chair, Representative, in terms of the commercial and this proposal very much is in keeping with the comprehensive plan that has been in existence for some time in the township of Hassan. It does, as I said, fit the management strategies that have been put forward. I mean, you've all been aware of the discussions in areas like east of St. Paul and other parts of the metropolitan area that have really resisted the kind of growth that is being proposed here. I think this provides an opportunity for the kind of infill development that really can capture some of that growth rather than just continuing to expand that farther and farther out into the region. And so I think from that perspective, and yes, a large portion of it is retail and commercial, but that is an important part of the tax base for the area as well. It's a very important piece of the overall tax base for all of the cities and certainly the county in that region. And it benefits, as I'm sure you know, now this kind of an interchange benefits a very, very large area, not just this particular developer. It's this developer who has stepped up and said that they will help pay for the costs of getting this moving and will take the risk of the district not generating enough revenue to pay them back within the time frame. It's a very short district. It's an 8-year district, and so will be over quickly. And if it doesn't generate enough revenue to pay back the cost of the interchange, all of that risk falls on the developer, not on the on the communities or the taxpayers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As someone who drives this stretch of road on a weekly basis, I can attest to the fact that traffic has continued to expand here on a regular basis. Regardless of the time of day or night, it's stop-and-go traffic. My question, Mr. Tinkenberg, is obviously there's got to be more to MnDOT's position here than current funding when they're looking at not doing anything here for another 20, 25, 30 years or whatever. What is your understanding as to why this has not risen higher on MnDOT's list of priorities?
Madam Chair, Representative, my understanding from the discussions boils down to a funding issue, that the priority has been at looking at additional lanes on 94. As you recall, the governor's bonding proposal had in it extending the third lane from Rogers out to Monticello, or actually Clearwater. And I think that's been the focus along this corridor. All of the conversations, and again, as Chair Sherber mentioned, his conversations with MnDOT are that they're supportive of the interchange, recognize the need for the interchange in that area, but that there is simply no funding. And as I recall, the numbers, they're 20-some billion dollars worth of needs around the state and only $2 or $3 billion or something to deal with them. And so it's been a matter of this just not being, there not being funding available to do this this interchange. But certainly supportive of other alternatives and supportive of the efforts to supplement this with federal funding.
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Tinkenberg, frankly, I think an interchange along here would do more to alleviate some of the traffic problems than another lane, and certainly would cost a lot less money. So if they're looking at lane addition and as an alternative, that certainly is going to cost a whole lot more. The other question I have, perhaps, is for the mayor of Dayton and also the representative from Hasson Township. If this interchange is built, are there going to be significant other arterial infrastructure improvements that are going to be needed? And if so, how does the city or the township intend to approach those?
We're in the process of studying right now what those actual needs are going to be. This section of freeway on the Dayton side, also we've got County Road 81, Botno Boulevard that comes from Minneapolis. That will be the location of a future busway or rail line at some point in time. They're studying that now. I know the legislature has approved some money in the past for that project. We are a little bit landlocked in the fact that we've got the river, Mississippi River, on our north border. We don't have any other access out except through Champlin or Rogers to get on 94. So it is quite a stretch. We are going through comp plan revision right now, too, that's going to determine what our access needs beyond this interchange will be. But, again, we've got 81 pretty close there that's going to take a lot of the traffic.
We are also going through a comp plan revision and in the process of updating it. And this, what we're asking for now, is just the right to create the Stiff District. And once we have that right, then we will go into the details about the adjacent roads and how everything is going to be applied. So some of it is kind of premature to do that right now at this point in time, so we know that the TIF district will be created. And one other point I wanted to bring out was, I don't remember the name of the hospital right now. I'm kind of nervous. North Memorial is building a new hospital out there. And with this intersection in, that will create a way to get to this hospital by people that are in need of their services. And I'll tell you right out, I know how important that is because I lost a child once here with in need of that service. And if we can put a road in like this that is going to benefit the people, you know, who knows, it might be your child, you know, that needs to get there fast. You know? And I hope you did a better job than they got with mine. But anyhow, it's real important. We really need your help on this. This is such a wonderful deal for our communities. I've lived here for 67 years, and this is one. And I've watched our communities grow, and this is one of the most important things that I can say is going to happen in my lifetime in our community. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, in the interest of time, I'm going to forego my questions for now.
Is there anyone else in the public who would like to testify either for or against? Any other questions from committee members? Representative Pepin,
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Just one question.
Representative Silver, yes.
For Mr. Tinklenburg. I just have one question for you. What is different with this TIF project when we've seen so many others come along? What would be different?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think there are some significant differences. The one is that this district goes, the revenue from this district goes entirely into the public infrastructure. None of it goes to write down the land costs for the developer, to write down utility costs, as a direct subsidy to the developer, none of that. In fact, as I mentioned earlier, in this district, the developer is actually contributing, a contributor to it, and is taking the risk. And so I think that's a really important distinction. The other is that it serves a regional purpose in that it allows for development to occur in a way that supports regional growth strategies and regional transportation strategies, in that it creates the density along a very important potential rail transportation corridor. And so there are a number of ways in which this represents, and with that, it's, as I mentioned, the Economic Development District is a very short district. It's only 8 years in duration, and that all of the residential and commercial taxes that will be generated in this district, and again, as I mentioned, it's approaching $1.5 billion in built-out value, thousands of jobs that will be created in this district, both in terms of construction jobs and in terms of permanent jobs, that this represents quite a change. You know, if you look at that kind of a build-out value versus a $20 million investment, the return on that investment is pretty remarkable and much better than what was mentioned earlier in terms of that one job at the Dairy Queen. I think so.
Oh, Madam Chair, I was just wondering what the head of our transportation committee thought of this, since his family business was right near there.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I didn't hear the question.
I just wondered what the representative leader thought of this proposal.
I have.
I'm very good. You know what representative leader thinks about this proposal?
Madam Chair, representative leader and I have talked on many things, but not specifically this this proposal. Most of our discussions have been in terms of broader transportation funding issues that that you all are facing.
Other questions? If not, well, Representative Kempin will give you closing comments here. I want to share, though, that I have talked to Representative Kempin about this privately, and I just want to share my thought. Frustration with these, and I understand where they're coming from, is they're no different than the St. Michael proposal of last year or 2 years ago, the Winona proposal of a couple of years ago. These are frustrations locally with the state not meeting its transportation funding responsibilities. And I think Representative Mullery and Representative Wolfsager both alluded to that. You know, it's a concern I have that if you're situated in a situation where you have the access to developers, so you can even come up with these financing mechanisms to fund MnDOT responsibilities, you have a little more ability to maybe do some of these things, but if you're not, you're just out of luck. And this really becomes driving which roads get done in which order because people aren't funding the MnDOT system. So I know Representative Pepin, you know, she's doing a good job fighting for her community here, but I wanted to be honest in my view of these. We've seen these regularly, and I personally have not been a fan of them because they are using TIF, which was never intended to finance the MnDOT roads, but I understand the frustration from speakers, and they're just looking for a way to get it done. So I just wanted to put it out there without sounding too gloomy, just so everybody knew the conversation that I'd already had with Representative Pepin, and I know that those who've served on the TIF working group over the years have heard these bipartisanly from lots of different members, so it's complicated, and I'm sure especially Mr. Tinklenberg can understand in his former role, but Representative Pepin, you wanted to give us one more pitch, and then we'll lay it over.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do appreciate you giving this bill a hearing, and I could go on and on about the importance of it, but I just do want to say that transportation funding is important, and I did support the governor's bonding package last year. I support the governor's bonding package this year because I think it brings the money in quickly. And I won't go into specific details about the transportation bill we debated for many hours on Saturday. I think that's irrelevant to this conversation. But again, I understand, Madam Chair, you're not a fan of this, but we can't neglect the fact that you know, it's not a perfect system, but MnDOT's not going to get to this for 25 or 30 years. Even if we were to pass the transportation package and raise every tax that there is and the bonding portion, there's no guarantee that this would be even moved up still. So I'm thinking that the only way we can get this done
is to take advantage of what the developer has been willing to put forward with risk. And I think this is just a great, unique opportunity, one that we might not get for a couple of years, if ever. And it just seems like all the stars are in alignment right now. I think that it's important to remember that this isn't just for the people of Rogers and Dayton. It's for anybody who's got a cabin up north. A six-mile stretch, if you're going up north and you're going on 94 to try to get to 101 to head up north by my house, there have been times when I've been stuck in traffic for 2.5 hours between those two interchanges. There is no escape route. If someone is in an accident, if one of your family members is in an accident on that stretch, there's absolutely no way to get out because the traffic is so much you can't even get an ambulance there. So having one more escape route is just of vital importance. And I understand that this isn't the perfect mechanism, but we really believe it's a really good compromise, and we're really happy that the developer is willing to work with us on this. And we hope you will give this some strong consideration, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pepin. I will lay over House Bill 1789 as amended. Thank you, Representative Pepin, and thank you for all your testifiers. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Representative Lane, House Bill 1879. Representative Nornes has people have to leave by 5:30, so we're going to go to Representative Lane, and then we want to get Representative Nornes up here because he has someone who has to leave. Again, if there is somebody else who has to leave, please send a note down to Sarah. So we know that, and members, we have the room here till 6, and then we've got it all night. I think a good goal, we moved to the basement room at 6, and we've got that till, I don't know, 10. I think we can get done by 6, if we're diligent, and then we won't have to move rooms, and we won't have to continue tonight. If it doesn't work, so be it, but I think we can make it. Representative
Madam Kuna. Chair, yes. I would be more than glad to move House File 2121 to move this along.
Representative Simpson, I think you mean House File 1879.
1879
is the one right now. All right, thank you.
1879.
Simpson. And Representative Simpson also moved the H1879A1 amendment to get it in the order. Representative Lane would like it. Is there a discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Welcome, Representative Lane.
Thank you, Madam Chair and the members. The amendment is in line with the Senate version, and it just limits certain types of businesses from the downtown area development, like billiard halls and automotive services. This TIF bill will provide us with the funding in Columbia Heights necessary to do absolutely necessary work to redevelop a small first-ring suburb with older homes, lots of senior citizens, and a lower tax base. We just don't want to have a downward spiral with poor conditions, can't afford to repair them, hence leading to more poor conditions. We want to revitalize, be very desirable. The part of the downtown area that we're talking about is right outside of Minneapolis. As you come down Central Avenue, 65, it used to be an old industrial dump, and it needs major cleanup. And then we can open that area up for major development that would be very attractive in that area. The funds would also go to a home rehab program and to a substandard home replacement program. So I have some representatives from our city to give you more details about that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bob Streeter with the City of Columbia Heights. If I could provide some context first. I'm here on behalf of the City Council because they're trying to tackle two big problems in the City of Columbia Heights, and that is the old dilapidated housing and a commercial dump in our downtown. What the council is asking to do is establish a housing revitalization district to generate the revenue to pay for cleanup, which is estimated to be between $3.5 and $4 million. This is a 4-acre site in downtown Columbia Heights. We currently have a preliminary development agreement with the developer where they're contemplating building 60 units of senior rental housing and about 10,000 or about 15,500 square feet of new commercial. This development will not be able to go forward because the cost of remediation exceeds the amount of increment that this project would be able to generate if we were to establish a tax increment district just for this project. The second and third thing that the City Council would like to do is establish a home replacement program. And what they'd like to do is identify approximately 5 homes a year, 125 over 25 years, acquire them voluntarily, tear them down, and then build new homes in their place. They would also like to establish a home rehab program and every year provide between 5 and 10 home loans or grants for folks whose homes aren't candidates for demolition but could be preserved. And let me provide some background about Columbia Heights. We are just north of northeast Minneapolis and east of north Minneapolis. The issue of housing in our neighborhoods has been a concern of families since the early 90s, as evidenced by a community survey. Two-thirds thought the city should put more money in renovating and rehabbing housing. Our structures are older, much older, than the average in the metropolitan area. The median year built in Columbia Heights is 1957. In the metro area, it's 1971. Our residential property values, which comprises 90% of our tax base, is some of the lowest in the metropolitan area. Only two cities in the metropolitan area have a lower average estimated market value for a single-family home out of 175. We did a survey of our properties, and over 200 had moderate to severe code deficiencies, and 59 were candidates for demolition. We're seeing a lot of our single-family homes and duplexes being converted to rental property because their poor condition makes them unmarketable as owner-occupied homes. Lastly, the median income in the city of Columbia Heights is three-quarters of the metropolitan area median. In fact, out of 189 metropolitan cities, only 9 have a lower median income, and one is the city of Hilltop, which is a trailer park in the middle of Columbia Heights. What we want to do, currently we have a pre-79 tax increment district that will expire in 2009. It generates $650,000 a year in tax increment, and currently it's paying off bonds that were used to build senior housing in the early 90s. What we want to do is establish a housing revitalization district, which means using the tax capacity of the pre-79, the tax capacity that was in place in the 70s, and use that but adopt all of the new rules as if it was being established today, which means it would pay into the fiscal disparities pool, and use that increment to collect $650,000 a year, or a little over $16 million over 25 years, to clean a dump and to replace old housing and to provide housing grants and loans. And I think the one last thing I'd like to say is we looked at all the other federal and state programs to see if there was any other way to do this. CDBG funds have been cut 16%. And anticipate over the last 5 years that are anticipated to be cut by 10% in 2007. We looked at the Med Council's program, which provides $5 million a year to potentially 106 cities for remediation. That money has not increased in 10 years. We looked at the DEED programs that metropolitan cities, about 140, have access to $3 million. Since the program's inception, that money has not increased and has been doubly oversubscribed since the program's inception. We looked at other housing programs that are available. The This Old House program that was started in 1993 and ended in 2003. When it was ended, we had 72 homes in the city of Columbia Heights participating. In fact, in the research I did, there were almost 57,000 homes in Minnesota in 86 out of 87 counties, and the program was terminated. That program was started to revitalize old neighborhoods in cities like Columbia Heights. We do not have access to that any longer. And then, as you've already discussed, if you look at tax increment financing, where we had a dollar to pay for cleanup and housing rehab, now we have 75 cents as a result of property tax reform. And then lastly, if the question is, well, why don't you just ask your voters to raise taxes? We had a net loss of $1.4 million in LGA, which was almost 70% of our general fund. Even so, our tax-supported funds went from 9.7 to 9.5 million. Between 2002 and 2007. So my point is, we're pretty tapped as a first-ring suburb. We don't have a lot of horsepower. You know, our tax base, our tax capacity is about 64% of the metro area average. And I think the bottom line is, the state has changed the rules and the resources, and I think we're being pretty creative by using our own money to solve problems that are going to be there, whether the resources are there or not, and we need to address them. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Did you have some just for questions.
Thank you. Are there questions for Representative Lane or for her testifier? Is there anyone in the public who would like to testify either for or against? Well, Representative Lane, you've been really patient. Maybe we're worn out. Representative Mueller.
Madam Chair, I just have to say this about, I understand how bad it's getting in Columbia Heights from a guy that called me
Saturday before last, I was working over here, and he called about a bill in my committee, and he said, you don't understand how bad it's getting in Columbia Heights. Those people from North Minneapolis are coming across the Camden Bridge, and you have no idea how bad those people in North Minneapolis are, and we're being invaded by them constantly. And after about 5 minutes of him telling them about how bad North Minneapolis people were, I mentioned to him that that's where I live.
Well, thank you, and thank you for your patience. I know you sat here a long time today, and we appreciate it. I think, Representative Lane, you've got a tough nut to crack here because you're trying to find these resources for this problem, and I know it's tough. I also spend a lot of time cutting through your district as well. I go up to the Blaine fields all the time. I'm very familiar with the area you're trying to work in, and we appreciate you coming today.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. I'll go ahead and lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Representative Lane, do you want to take Fridley? Can we do that quickly?
That would be great.
Norris has some folks have to leave, or would rather...
I think it would be great to do it right now, if it's possible.
Okay, so Representative Mullery will help solve 2121, Representative Lane's Fridley 5th District. Welcome to the committee.
You moved the bill, right? Okay, thank you. I have a briefer overview of this, just that it has to do with the North Star station that was removed because the Burlington Northern said that it had to, the station had to go in the middle of the tracks, which meant that a station, a tunnel or a skyway bridge would be needed. That was so expensive that they eliminated the station from the North Star route. This is very difficult because it could be very, very much used by this area of town, and we need to get it back. So these folks have also been very creative in thinking about how to do that.
Thank you, Scott Lund, Mayor Fridley, Madam Chair, representatives. We tried to put our thinking caps on and trying to come up with a proactive way of trying to encourage the North Star Rail, the Federal Transit Authority, and all those players in getting a station back into Fridley because of the high cost and the elimination in the first round of funding. We have existing tax increment districts, but we'd like to create or expand that this district into this district to assist in monies for a rail site. Again, as Representative Lane had mentioned, one of the things, one of several areas that we can assist in with that, with this generation of money in the TIF district would be a tunnel. As a standalone project, it's an excellent project as well. We have a well-worn path for pedestrians that illegally, almost daily, cross the tracks because we have no east-west corridor. We either go down to 694, which is not conducive to pedestrian traffic, or you travel over a half a mile to the north to cross at Mississippi Street. We have no connections across those rail tracks. Therefore, a tunnel is most cost-effective, cheaper than an overhead that we could install for our pedestrian and bikeway pathway, which would interconnect with existing regional walkway, bikeway trails now. There is an immediate, a block away is one of our elementary schools, and as well as people traverse across the railways now to get onto the bus transit system on University Avenue, which is only a block or so away. And again, as a standalone project, this would be excellent to assist in the North Star Rail Authority in infrastructure for roadway improvements for the access. Fridley is a fully developed community, and even with that, we have the unique opportunity that there is two adjacent properties, one on the east and one on the west of the existing station site, the proposed station site. The North Star Rail has already purchased the west property, and it's more difficult to purchase the east side of that property, which from both major highways, East River Road and University Avenue, makes a great access from both sides of the tracks for the station that would be built between the two tracks. I think that this is absent of actual cash, that this is the best way to funnel some monies into a visible project that could produce noticeable results. Not only do we need the good-paying jobs that will be generated by this construction, there is a huge public cost of delay. In that, I'm speaking specifically of, you know, inflationary measures. The costs just keep escalating all the time, so the delays in that. And we do firmly believe, it's well documented, that with this seed planted, being a construction of this station site, will generate other redevelopment in the area that's sorely needed. We have some of our worst crime area is very close to that proposed station site, with 12 apartment buildings that are in poor condition. Even with our rental housing inspection, those that there's a considerable amount of blight, and we feel that redevelopment could occur much more readily if we have a station site there. So we do feel that this will help a lot. We have the district, we have increment already, and we'd like to expand it into this rail site to be proactive in getting that station back online.
Thank you. Representative Lane, did you have further testimony?
Yes, did you have any more to say? District issue?
Yeah, Representative Lane and members, Chair Lane and, I'm sorry, thank you, Winchowski, please, and representatives, thank you. I would be glad to stand for questions if you have planning issues. My name is Scott Hickok. I'm the Community Development Director for the City of Fridley, and thank you.
Thank you for being here.
Madam Chair, I'm Jim Casserly, and I work with the City of Fridley with its legal and financial analysis on redevelopment. This is just a wonderful opportunity for the city to try to take advantage of a station that has been discussed for many years. And the two parts to this bill that are a little bit unusual. One is the ability to use some funds in some already existing districts. And that really amounts to about $2.4 million. And that is what is in the bill. The second part of the bill is allows the area to be, all of the parcels to be included in a redevelopment tax increment financing district. I believe this is about a 55-acre site. It contains some vacant land that would not qualify. It contains other parcels that would be qualifying in one kind of a district but not in another kind. And the way we would address that is by allowing the parcels to be included in this single district. And all of the funding are really designed to assist with infrastructure development. What is particularly difficult in all of our inner suburban communities is to assist with parking treatments and parking structure. In order to maximize the use of the transfer station and in order to get the maximum development that should occur, our problem is designing infrastructure and parking, and that's what this would be for.
Thank you. Are there questions from committee members? Is there someone from the public who would like to testify to the floor against this bill? Representative
Silvery. I'm really glad that you brought this forth, obviously, since I'm a Fridley resident. And but all biases aside, I think this would be the best legislation we need to get through.
Representative Lane, I think, except for his North Star sales tax exemption provision, which I think we're hearing, I don't know, tomorrow or the next day, but that will be equally as important, I'm sure.
But for today.
But for today, yes. And we do appreciate that you're trying to creatively get a station there, and I'm sure it's a difficult thing to come up against. Representative Lane.
North Star just shooting right on by is kind of a silly thing, I think. And in the planning of North Star, this was an important piece, and it had to be let go of because of the costs of getting on both sides of the situation. So it just had to be let go by not enough funding at that level. So trying to solve that problem, and then when that happens, get that North Star station back, the whole area can be developed, and this would serve that process.
Thank you, Representative Lane. I will then lay over Representative Lane's bill. Thank you, testifiers, for joining us today, and thank you for your patience. Thank you. And Representative Norneth, you've been so patient, and he has testifiers who have to leave. And I will move House File 1650. Again, thank you, Representative Norneth, for your patience. Welcome.
Thank you.
We've got extra chairs, so just pull up.
Right.
Pull a chair up.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Awesome.
I was going to cast a seventh inning stretch to just make everybody alert. I think we have some things that are kind of exciting to talk about for the next few minutes. House File 1650 deals with a building that Fergus Falls has had in its city limits for about 110 years. It's the old Regional Treatment Center. In the state of Minnesota, within the next year, about a year from now, we'll be vacating the building completely. And the city is now in the position of, what do we do with the building? And there's a real strong effort being made to save that structure plus some other buildings that are adjacent to it. The alternative outcome would be a demolition. We really would like to avoid that if we can. What we're proposing, and again, this is limited just to the campus of the Fergus Falls Regional Treatment Center, is to develop a Renaissance zone, and that is one of the tools that our testifiers with me today will explain. It's very important to find developers who will risk some capital to save the structure and provide a new use. So I think without any further delay, I'd like to introduce Harold Stanislawski, and
awesome.
Take it over.
Stanislawski, did I say that right?
That's correct. Very good. Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we're all delighted to be here from Fergus Falls today. It's such a beautiful day to be here at our state's capital. In your packet, you have a picture of your state regional treatment center. And I say your regional treatment center because this is state-owned property. It's 744,000 square feet and 24 buildings. And the big building is called the Kirkbride. It's in a horseshoe shape. And it sits on 116 acres right on the north side of Fergus Falls. And clearly, this facility has a marvelous history in our town of treating patients for well over 100 years. This facility, when it was built to last, I'm told, for 600 years. It's done about 100 years of service. It's got 500 years left. It's told me it wants to continue. However, the state of Minnesota, because of changing times, no longer has use for this facility, but we feel there may be a use for it in the world of commerce. The state of Minnesota Department of Human Services, as Representative Nornes said, has operated several programs out of the Fergus Falls RTC for many years, and sometime about this time next year, the last program will leave the RTC building and be located in a new facility in Fergus Falls, leaving this campus completely vacant. The state has initiated a process for reuse with the city of Fergus Falls. Failure to find a reuse may result in this building being demolished as the last remaining intact Kirkbride facility in America. The estimated cost for demolishing this facility was put together by the BKV group back in 2004 at a cost to the state of Minnesota at $9.8 million, excluding landfill costs. So this is a very expensive proposition for the state of Minnesota to demolish, and we think we might have an opportunity for redevelopment, but we need some help. Our group, if you look in your packet, we've passed resolutions of support for the Renaissance Zone from Otter Tail County Board of Commissioners, from the Fergus Falls City Council, and from our Chamber of Commerce Board of Directors. They're all interested in seeing this this happen. Some of us went out to Traverse City, Michigan, to look at a Kirkbride facility very similar to this, and that is where we started seeing success in how to redevelop an elephant like this. And you got to do it one bite at a time, and we think this Renaissance Zone could be an appropriate fix. I'd like now to, with that introduction, to turn it over to our Honorable Mayor, Russ Anderson.
Welcome, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair and committee members. I serve as the mayor of the city of Fergus Falls. We are a city of just about 14,000 people up in northwestern Minnesota, and I would like to address some points here regarding this Renaissance proposal. And the city of Fergus Falls has worked tirelessly to help the state address and solve the problems related to their departure from this regional treatment center. We have been the long-term energy supplier for the regional treatment center for this campus. We have helped the tenants relocate from the campus, some of those being state agencies. We have constructed, at city expense and now leased to the state of Minnesota, a new community-based health hospital. We are working with Otter Tail County to construct a new chemical dependency hospital. That would be a 60-bed unit. Sewer expansions and street improvements to this unit will be made at city expense. We have acquired two parcels of land from the state, which is a total of 55.64 acres, and are working to sell that land to developers for redevelopment, and the money received from the sales of those properties will be returned to the state of Minnesota. And we have initiated a process to acquire another parcel of land from the state, which is closer to downtown. It's just approximately 17 acres, and this will be used for city parkland, and this acquisition will also relieve the state of a tremendous amount of maintenance responsibility. The treatment center is a state-owned facility, and I believe we have stepped up to the plate to help redevelop this unit. It has been designated as a Job Z zone, and traditional economic development tools are also available for development and redevelopment. However, when you're going to redevelop something of over 700,000 square feet in a community the size of Fergus Falls, it requires more tools than are currently available to us. And this request is for the Fergus Falls Regional Treatment Center campus only. And if the state would like to make this available for other communities, that is certainly their prerogative. However, we believe this to be a very unique circumstance. It is a state facility that has historic and economic importance. It is for job creation, business development, and historic preservation and renewal. Those are the primary goals of this treatment center campus. The resulting effects of such a zone would be to provide mixed-use tax-based incentives to spur job creation, business, and housing development.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Appreciate your testimony.
Madam Chair, also with us today is Rick Anderson, who is a businessman in Fergus Falls, to talk a little bit about some of the intricacies of the Renaissance Zone itself.
Welcome, Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chairman, representatives, Harold and myself and three developers made a trip over to Traverse City, Michigan, to look at their Kirkbride project. It's a very difficult building to redevelop. Fergus Falls is unique in the fact that it's set up as a dormitory style. The width of the building, it is one-third of a mile long. The width of the building is only 50 feet wide. It's got about an 8 or 10 foot hallway right down the middle, so it's very difficult to redevelop. And in dealing with the gentleman over in Traverse City, they have indicated to us that without incentives, it's very, very difficult for a developer to step up to the plate and to come up with a plan for redevelopment. They can go into a project with preconceived ideas and say housing is going to be the answer or offices will be the answer, but it's really the market that dictates the reuse of that facility. In Fergus Falls, we have about 50 housing permits per year, so we're not looking at this isn't like the previous communities that have stepped forward and asked for different types of incentives. What we're asking for is an abatement of taxes on a property that has never paid taxes in the last 110 years to allow us time to provide incentives to people to step up to the plate and redevelop. We're looking at housing, nonprofit training, educational use, potentially some very small retail. We have a retail zone in Fergus Falls. When retailers come to Fergus, they look at traffic counts, and we do have plenty of vacancies at our mall and in our retail area, so it isn't going to be retail or anything like that. But what the Renaissance Zone allows is tools in the toolbox for a developer to step forward and say, I'll take that risk and I will redevelop that property And in a community like Fergus Falls, if we're able to redevelop 700,000 square feet, eventually we'll have a tremendous economic benefit to our community.
Madam Chair.
For your testimony.
I just wanted to add one thing. We haven't talked too much about the specifics of the Renaissance Zone, but the one thing it does is allow this development to take place in stages. We don't think anyone is going to come in with one grand idea to do the whole project. It will be done in pieces over a period of years. So, you know, just a portion at a time. And that's why the legislation is the way it is. It allows for that kind of a piecemeal process to take place.
Thank you for that. And Representative Nornes, this picture, I've never been there.
Oh.
Huge.
They give tours.
Wow. And I can see, and we would like to see that if you could pass that around. This does present quite a, looks like a really good place to film a movie.
Oh, it's a beautiful place. Madam Chair.
Representative Housen has a film tax for the building.
Madam Chair, that has been suggested among a lot of other ideas for that facility. I mentioned the tours. You would guess that the community that's kind of taken this building for granted for many years wouldn't be interested in going up there and having tours. But they have had, I forget the number now, but over 2,000 people had taken the time to go up there and take that tour. That's very historic, and it's part of it that takes you back to the early years of the building that hasn't been really touched. So it's kind of like stepping back in time, and parts of the building are up to date and very modern.
And Representative Nornes, Representative Carlson and Simpson have questions, but if I may just ask one more, and that is Representative Marquardt, I think, is the chief author of the historic tax credit this year, and I think Representative Lanning carried it in the past. Is this, does this qualify on the National Historic Register?
Yes, yes.
It's listed up this time.
Yes, it does.
Okay, thank you for that information. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, it is an interesting place to tour. We years and years ago visiting college, and some of the committee members saw the building up there, and they did take a little sight, but not a throw. That was my question, being that we got into the tours. It's not clear to me, Representative Nornes, once the building is vacated and you have a fairly extensive timeline need to get this redeveloped, who's responsible for the maintenance of the building until it's redeveloped? What happens there, and how can that be funded?
Well, we've been talking with the state of Minnesota through a number of years now as this process has been going on, where they've been moving, you know, from the campus. And that's one of the things that's being negotiated between the city and the state. There's a, you know, the one thing we don't want is for the heat, for the building to be cold. We want it to be heated and so it can be maintained to a certain degree so it doesn't deteriorate any further. But again, that hasn't been determined yet. The city is very interested in doing their part. The city, as you can understand, doesn't want the full responsibility of that building until we have some understanding as far as safeguarding our taxpayers. And as Harold mentioned, there's a large amount of money that would be needed to tear it down. And what was done with some outbuildings, the city has taken ownership with the understanding that if they are not developed, there is money set aside to pay for the demolition. So the city is safe, the state is protected, and I think that's similar to where we're going here with, again, negotiations on who will take care of the building.
And Madam Chair, being that that's being negotiated, then I assume there's not a request then before the legislature at this point in time, because you were thought that it sounds like you're trying to negotiate some sort of a partnership between the city and the state.
Well,
as a building will, as we all know, deteriorate very rapidly if it's...
Madam Chair and Representative Carlson, I don't think we're looking at a partnership exactly, because I think the state definitely wants to be out of town. So it's what we can negotiate to make that happen, while the citizens of Fergus Falls are still held harmless, and the end result is we create some new jobs and preserve this historic building.
Madam Chair, we can talk about that later because we've got a number of bills, but it seems to me that's going to be an issue if you're going to preserve it, just how you handle the maintenance and how that would be funded. But I'll stop.
Madam Chair, you know, we are in a race right now because there are some buildings associated with this that I understand they've actually had a few holes knocked in them in preparation for demolition. So we need to move as fast as we can to stop that process, at least until we have a chance to examine all of the options that we are looking for. So.
Thank you. And Representative Simpson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. More of a comment, and it kind of goes off of Representative Carlson. I think I sat in on a briefing here recently, and once the state walks away from this facility, there's going to be a cost of about $1 million a year to maintain it, because they feel that they're responsible to maintain it, Representative Carlson, to a point that it doesn't deteriorate. So we have an outstanding cost here that's going to be a continue for until they make a commitment to either tear it down, which is like a $10 million demolition plus landfill cost, or until they take the responsibility of moving it. I think this whole Renaissance Zone is a pretty unique approach to trying to move this to a different direction. And I think that as a tax division, I think we need to look at this and look at it very seriously. If we want to try to alleviate a problem that the state has and try to work with a community that's willing to take that responsibility and that liability, I think we need to look at this real strongly. And if you look, get a chance to go through this Michigan Renaissance thing, I think it really gives a good understanding how they've done it and how it's worked well for them. And I think I certainly think it has been. So just for what it's worth.
Thank you. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to raise the same question that Representative Simpson was posing. So really, as I understand this, failure to do anything now is going to end up potentially costing the state a lot of money, either on maintaining this facility or tearing it down. And so unlike other proposals, we've got something seriously financially at stake here as a state with regard to this project. And the only other thing I would mention, the city of Fargo, North Dakota has made very effective use of Renaissance Zone in their downtown area. And anybody who's followed that and knows anything about it, has been a real major revival of the downtown area in Fargo, North Dakota as a result of a similar program.
Yes, and Madam Chair, if the 60-bed facility that's being under construction will be completed in sometime next spring, February or March or so, so that this initial year there won't be any issue as far as maintenance on that because the state will still be occupying it. So.
Thank you for that, Representative Nornes. Thank you. I think we're all very impressed and now puzzled as to what to do. It's quite a puzzle, but it's a beautiful, beautiful facility.
We want to just go ahead.
Madam Chair, one comment. Representative Lanning mentioned Fargo, North Dakota. We met with the building planner for Fargo, North Dakota. They started their Renaissance Zone, which is also patterned after the Michigan Renaissance Zone. It has been very successful. They started in 1999 with their Renaissance Zone. They had a taxable base downtown Fargo of only $200,000 a year. In 5 years, they're starting to get some of their properties back on the tax roll, and they're collecting over $600,000 a year. They've had their taxable base right now went from $11 million in properties, it's now worth $65 million. In 2009, they're going to be collecting over $900,000 a year in real estate taxes downtown Fargo. So it's been very successful with 143 successful projects downtown Fargo. And that is patterned after the Renaissance Zone in Michigan. So the Renaissance Zone in Fergus basically puts us on a level playing field with North Dakota and South Dakota.
Thank you. And we're going to go to Representative Earhart, and we've got 3 bills to do in 15 minutes. Representative Earhart.
Madam Chair, I was late, so I was just hoping you would explain to Representative Nornes that the citizens of Hennepin County are not going to pay for this, no matter how hard you try.
Just a little sales tax, bud.
And
thank you for that. Thank you very much.
I just want to thank you, the committee, for hearing this bill, and we'll go forward. Okay?
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Bill for possible inclusion in the office tax bill. Thank you very much. And Representative Hillstrom has Brooklyn Center 2 bill here, House Bill 2192 and House Bill 2193, and I think they might be different versions solving the same problem. Not sure. Representative Hillstrom moves House Bill 2192. And thank you for your patience. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move House Bill 2192 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. Both of the bills that you have before you are TIF changes for the City of Brooklyn Center, and with me is Brad Hoffman, City Planner.
Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. Welcome.
Economic Development Director, sorry.
Whoever you are, welcome, Mr. Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Brad Hoffman. I'm the Community Development Director for Brooklyn Center. House File 2192 and its companion bill 2193 represent a request from the City of Brooklyn Center to modify existing special legislation affecting a redevelopment district within TIF district within Brooklyn Center. The special legislation as it currently exists requires that 15% of the total TIF revenues be used for housing-related activities. This particular TIF project or TIF district is principally directed at commercial redevelopment within specific areas of Brooklyn Center and affords few opportunities really to address a great number of housing activities since it is principally commercial property. And hence, the request in 2192 broadens the scope of what the definition of housing basically and allows the city to consider projects that would include the construction of new housing as well as other related housing activities. And also eliminates language that no longer references to language or statutes that no longer exist. 2193 also relates to this same 15% fund in that it would allow the city to undertake those activities anywhere within the city and basically gives the city the opportunity to make more prudent and appropriate use of those funds, those housing funds, within the city as opposed to trying to find a place to make them work within this commercial district. It also contemplates that that expenditure outside the district would be considered as an expenditure within the district, or in other words, it's not subject to the 25% cap on expenditures outside the district. Another element of 2193 also is that within this particular district and a redevelopment site that we have currently prepared for redevelopment, there were two existing gas stations and a dry cleaner. Dry cleaner goes back to the 1950s. It had a leak of product over several decades. We have at this point in time cleaned the site, but that product has found its way to groundwater. It has it's made its way into the adjoining neighborhood, which is a residential neighborhood, which is outside of the district. And this would allow us to use revenues, tax increment revenues from this district outside the district, but can consider to be expenditures within the district to explore the scope of that particular project or that particular environmental issue and potentially look at remediations. Remediations we don't know at this point until we get our hands around the scope of the project.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Many of you remember the eminent domain hearings that took place in Brooklyn Center. This property that we are talking about is the property that we acquired through eminent domain. What ended up happening, again, is once we took the property, we found out that there was this pollution had migrated off the site and actually did contaminate the neighborhood and the groundwater. So this is the same, very same property that you have all heard about.
Thank you for that clarification, and many of us were there, so that is helpful. Representative Mallory.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to say to Representative Earhart, if you think Minneapolis uses TIF, you should look at Brooklyn Center.
Are there other questions? Is there anyone in the public who would like
couple
to
people know.
Testify for or against? If not, I'm going to lay over the first one, which was moved, which is House Bill 2192 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. And Representative Wilson, did you want to move the next one?
Yes, Madam Chair, I will move House Bill 2193 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
And I will lay that over as well. And I, again, want to appreciate so much your assistance and often. And we know this is a difficult fight, and we appreciate you bringing it to our attention. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you. And now Representative Mullery moves House File 2171. And we want to thank Mr. Casterly for hanging in there to the end. And
you can be assured that this is the end of Representative Mullery's legislative session.
I really doubt it. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll move House File 2171 for possible inclusion. This is a really simple bill. It's just that the authority can delay the receipt up to 4 years of the increment, and a lot of times in the first couple of years there's little or almost no increment, and in essence this will probably give two effective years of delay. And with me here to explain the bill is Mr. Jamboy, formerly of DFED, and a former Northside Minneapolis legislator, Mr. Casserly, who was actually, I believe, here when the law for TIF was enacted, weren't you?
There's some history going on in here. Welcome, Mr. Casserly and Mr. Jamboy.
Well, Madam Chair, your kindness is only exceeded by your patience. I was on not only on the committee, I was on the conference committee, and after 4 hours of listening to this kind of stuff, I would just glaze right over. So thank you for bearing up. We'll be extremely short. What happens, and what this bill, what we really need, I was the original author of the Tax Increment Act. And so I'm always amazed to come back.
Just the flat turbo.
Yeah, I know. I used to be a banker. I am kind of an attorney. You can dislike me for so many reasons. And a former legislator. It's just a whole range of them. But what happens in our complicated redevelopment districts is that we have such a long lead time. And our problem is it's hard to get the right qualifications sometimes. So we have to create the districts at an appropriate time. And it's often 2 and 3 years and 4 years. We've got one now that's almost 5 years before we have our first redevelopment that's actually occurring. What is happening is that, and I just verified again today, in one of our projects in New Brighton, this Northwest Quad you hear about, this is a really tough project to do. And we got our first increment. We created the district in right at the end of 2004. We got our first increment, $2,510. The increment for this particular district, when it's built out, is going to be several million a year. We have issued 17 million dollars worth of debt so far. We're in the process of we're going to be issuing maybe another $13 million. What happens to us is obvious. We really lose several years of increment, and because of the way the law works, it's 25 years from date of first receipt. Well, it doesn't say first receipt of how much, or first receipt of full build out, or first receipt of 50% of full build out. It's just first receipt, and a lot of increment will be generated in these tough districts because we've taken out the junk and sometimes improve the area enough that we start creating increment before there's even any other development that occurs. We've taken down the buildings, we've taken out the junk, we've remediated the sites, so we will have some increment occurring. It'll be nominal because we've had so many buildings we've taken out that the actual increase in land value will just create this nominal increment. That's it, Ms. Madam Chair. I really appreciate the committee's patience. It really would help specifically in redevelopment and soils condition districts. In the middle 90s, I think, Bill, we tried to address this issue in a very convoluted way. Ultimately, it was so complicated that it got repealed, what, about 8 years later, 9 years later, in which we allowed an election to defer the creation of a redevelopment and housing district, and then you opted for a period that was shorter, on and on and on. Didn't work. No one ever did it. And so now we're trying again to address this kind of complicated issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Jamboy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair members, I'm Louis Jamboy, the Executive Director of Metro Cities, and we've got 1 minute, and I'll take less than that. I'm not going to add anything to Mr. Casserly's presentation, except that this bill was put together by a collective that included Minnesota Solutions, Metro Cities, League of Minnesota Cities, and TIP Junkies Everywhere. We have attempted to put together something that's really simple, straightforward, and will help cities with their cash flow on TIP districts, particularly the difficult ones that start late because of market conditions or site problems. We think it's really very straightforward, and we very much appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the public who would like to testify the for or against Bill 2171? Are there questions from committee members? If not, I will lay over House File 2171 for possible inclusion on the tax bill. And thank you, Representative Mullery and testifiers. Representative Dammer moves the minutes. That's all right, Representative Dammer?
Yes.
Whatever date.
Yes, I was here.
Yes. Thank you. Discussion, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The minutes are adopted. Members, you don't have to meet tonight. Thank you for your patience. We'll see you tomorrow morning. We are adjourned, guys.